is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
You're listening to News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained since January 1997. We began our 25th year in broadcasting in January 2022, and we're just getting started, exploring the edge of human consciousness and possibility on planet Earth with founder and journalist Nicole Marie Whitney at the helm. What's really real? And what's really possible? That is what we want to know. Join us at newsforthesoul.com. newsforthesoul.com.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online. This is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
You're listening to News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained since January 1997. We began our 25th year in broadcasting in January 2022, and we're just getting started, exploring the edge of human consciousness and possibility on planet Earth with founder and journalist Nicole Marie Whitney at the helm. What's really real? And what's really possible? That is what we want to know. Join us at newsforthesoul.com. newsforthesoul.com.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
Okay, I think we're all here and we're live. This is it, Open Search Outward, with myself and former CIA remote viewer David Morehouse, who has been on the show and one of my favorite teachers of experience in the search out there, trying to find out what's really real and what's really possible for, oh my gosh, over 2 decades, if you can imagine that. David, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. You've got that. I've been talking long hours. Voice again.
Me? Oh, I just got finished at 4 o'clock this morning.
So. Oh, my gosh. Well,
don't forget, I'm on, 6 to 8 hours now. It used to be 10 to 15 hours, but you cut it down. So, yeah, I sound a little froggy. I've been, got a couple hours of sleep, maybe, if the dog wasn't licking my face. To go pee, and here I am.
Fresh as a daisy. Well, here we are. I'm very grateful to be here. I know we've missed a couple of weeks, mostly on my account, but here we are, moving forward. as I said in the intro, and as the intro itself said, you know, we've been trying to search from the very beginning. That's the very thing that drives News for the Soul, is what's really real and what's really possible. And one of the biggest pieces in that search for me was working with you and remote viewing and your prolific ability to explain the physics of the metaphysics and so on. So we're searching together now on this show. So what's on Dave's mind today? That's what I want to know.
Well, we had our great show last night. We had a Dakota Sioux Indian on board. He was a medicine man. And it was fun. The room was mesmerized. The room's got, I think it's approaching, this is just our club. It's close to 4,000 members now. And through the night, people come in and check in, listen, stay, don't stay, leave quietly, you know, all these different things. It was amazing. So last night, we started off with a no-topic show, which is always, met by the moderators with a little intrepidation. Why? Because you can get some really howling wolves that could come in there that are not cool. And the stuff they talk about is bizarre. And we don't want to do that. You know, I'm grounded in reality and science and stuff like that, which I know may be juxtaposed to many listeners, but it's just who I am. I don't believe everything, you know, and I look for qualitative, quantitative evidence of the ability to do what you say you do. And that's it. So this guy was fun. His name is Kenny, and he was there with us as a Sioux medicine man, talking about his experiences as a Sioux medicine man. And, of course, I was being my typical self, was like, hey, so, okay, let me get this straight. You got called into a ceremony, and they said to you they were bringing in the ceremony to be a Sioux medicine man. True? He goes, yeah. I said to him, it's a good thing I wasn't one of the elders sitting there, because I would have said, hey, you have to go back to the lodge building. Somewhere in there, there's an application for a medicine man. Find that. Fill it out and bring it back here. We'll consider it. He started laughing. I went, no. I mean it. If I had been there as an elder, I would have said, go get this damn thing. There's only three of them in there, we think. But we haven't made any medicine men in a long time. So go find the application. He howled laughing. It was funny because it wasn't like that. But he had to be chosen to be a medicine man. And he talked about, in limited terms, about the ritual of becoming a medicine man and what they do and how they use peyote and other stuff. It was interesting. We had a good time. And it got weird toward the end.
I bet it did.
It always seems to go too far. And when it starts to go too far, I start to rein it in because I really want people to understand the credibility of this individual. I don't want them to start going, oh, shit, just another crazy, because when they start going, well, you know, we told any other visiting shaman, because we don't really particularly care for shaman or, you know, like what they're about, particularly when they put shaman on the sides of their vans and then come in and want to meet with our elders, et cetera. He said, we don't let them do that. We don't let them get around the round rocks either. I'm like, whoa, round rocks? Round rocks, yeah. These rocks that are round, he says. I go, you mean like dinosaur rocks, like the rocks that you can find all over the Wyoming Badlands and how they're big? There are these big round rocks that they're round because they were swallowed by a dinosaur and they were carried in their stomach and they use them to grind up the vegetative matter or protein that they consume. And when, of course, they die, then all the tissue is decayed and gone, but the rock, the stones sit there. So they call them dinosaur stones or gallstones or other kinds of weird things for dinosaurs. And I said, is that what you mean? He goes, oh, no. These are round stones that we sent to spy on our enemies. Wait a minute. So you're saying that you sent your people, which I said, how many different tribes are there in the Sioux? And he goes through like, oh, well, it depends on what you're talking about. There's like 15 different political variations, but 5 different tribal variations. Like, I said, like, did Custer know this? I go, this is why Custer got slaughtered. He had no freaking idea that all there were this, you know, this many of you. Oh, okay, back to where we were again. I go, so you have stones that you sent to do what precisely? We sent these stones to spy on our enemies, to look at what our enemies were doing. And I was thinking, okay, I said, well, that sounds a little bit like a Tolkien to me. You know, like Return of the King, remember the big round eye stone that if you uncovered it, it could see what the hobbits were doing. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah. So whenever my brain draws these conclusions, it's not maybe that it's right or this guy's wrong. It's just that, so you had rock drones. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, rock drones. I'm like, okay, rock drones. So then I'm typing to the moderators. I'm going, okay. So I'm not disputing it. I have no evidence of it. But if you had rock drones and you knew where the presence of your enemy was, how the hell did the Bluecoats kick your ass and take over all your property and land? How'd that happen? Right? So it's like, this is my logic brain. It's kind of like, really? Because I would say if you had rock drones, things you could send and your medicine men could see what they were seeing, see the disposition of the U.S. cavalry, you know, that was out on the on the plains. I would have thought you had had a big leg up, you know? I don't know.
Well, you know what?
That's me.
If you put it into your own experiential Rolodex, as you like to say, I mean, you can remote view. You can be a photon of light in relative to space and time, but you don't see everything.
Do you think it's like a peyote-driven experience, or do you believe that they...
No, I'm just so glad that you brought this up. Because I have a good story for this one. And again, it comes down to direct experience, because I wouldn't have believed any of this until I had a profound direct experience, well, a few of them. You know, one of my most profound works has been working with you and doing the remote viewing, extended work, and the explorers and all that stuff. The other most profound experiences, other than my awakening stuff, was with the indigenous community. And it was, they got me to have this experience, my upstairs team, I call them, early on, so I would get out of journalist mode. I was very stuck in journalist mode in the early days, where it had to look like the same as the other kind of newspapers, and it had to be exactly done this way as a paper, a physical paper, and blah, blah, blah. And I went to an experience called INIPI. But I'd love to hear more about what you say before I tell you what happened there.
Well, was this Mount Shasta?
Good God, no.
No.
You're going to have no woo-woo frame of reference for my story whatsoever.
No, I have no woo-woo. Okay, good. Good for you, girl. All right, I love you. I know it. So I love you. So you know the way I think. I was going to trick you into the Mount Shasta story and go, okay, now let's talk about this. So, So what do I believe that it can happen? Yes. Absolutely. I believe that ancient peoples and ancient civilizations, you know, were connected in ways that we lost or never. I mean, we always had the potential. We always were born with the ability, right? We know that, Daniel. You're born with these abilities to be connected, to be to recognize and embellish your omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, your eternal nature. But the rules of the society governing, you know, the established limitations of the legions of the status quo, they are the ones that tell you what you can and you cannot do. And we adopt that, much to our chagrin and much to our limitation, our promise, our potential. So when I talk to a medicine man of the Dakota, and he is practiced, studies, works, you know, believes, is a guy who recognizes that they've lost their youth. They're losing their youth. Their youth no longer care about their original language. They don't care about their original crafts. They don't care about their original beliefs. They're off part of trying to be at light speed, you know, to be whatever else they can be, but not that. So there are a few of them that remain in the tribe that continue this progression, this morphic resonance that the tribe has. So I believe what he says to me. I don't believe in things like, they don't call it this, but essentially what was described last night was like psychic surgery. When I hear that term, I think John of God. And John of God was not a spiritual man. John of God was a guy that was using a ruse to get into the pants of every young female that he could. That's what he was doing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he was just a scumbag, you know, who became a wealthy scumbag because people were flocking from all over the world. Even David Hughes. You know David Hughes.
Yes,
right?
I know. He told me about his experience there.
Yeah. Well, he told it, you know, tried to tell it in a positive light, but if you're looking behind his eyes, he was like, you know, that was a bunch of crap, you know, that kind of thing. So it was not unusual for the guy to, like, secret, you know, sleight of hand, a scalpel blade, and, you know, to cut you so that there was some pain and blood. But what he was pulling out of you was not a tumor. It wasn't anything else. This was not a holy man that was healing.
No, he was a sexual predator.
He was a sexual predator, yeah. But he was a sexual predator that people came from all over the world to stand in his presence, right? And so.
Yep.
Point is, use some damn discretion about these things before you jump in. And you have heard that from me for decades now, and I know that's what you talk about. But I believe what these guys say, but I don't believe it when he starts talking psychic surgery. I don't believe it when he starts talking, you know, miraculous immediate healings. Like, you know, grandmother shows up and she has a basketball-sized tumor in her abdomen, and two medicine men work on her, and within 30 minutes she comes back out and there's no evidence of a tumor. I wish that was happening. I truly, absolutely, I'd sever a finger or two if that were true. Why? Because I would love to see people live. I don't want to see people die, and I don't want to see people die without hope. But I'm also not a supporter of hoaxes. And so when he started saying that kind of stuff, I started like reining in, you know, his free time on air, because it was like, look, I love you, I respect you, I do. I feel ashamed for how your people were treated. I really do. But we have to keep this honest and provable and evidential, and, you know, and we have to keep it that humble, because if we start making boastful comments. What?
Here's the spiritual aspect to it, is you're not always going to be able to get that, David. This is why you need the direct experience to know. Like, you can listen to the stories and go, yeah, okay, you know, but you're never going
to
get there.
Okay, so what was your direct experience, my dear? What did they do to you that, you know, changed you, healed you?
I'm telling you, I needed this early I was a journalist who left the mainstream news business, started a positive news newspaper because I, you know, basically heard a voice saying, build it and they'll come. And so that's kind of where I was at. But I was very much still coming from my mind. I didn't believe anything that I hadn't experienced. And, you know, in a way, nor should you, right? Like you say, be discerning. When I had the newspaper, I had an advertiser who turned out to be an Olympian skier from Germany, and she had a connection with the indigenous community locally. So that's a really big leap and stretch of how dots connected. But that was the dot connection that happened. And she gave me this surreptitious kind of voicemail one day in the office saying, there's this Indian thing. It's supposed to be a healing ceremony, and it's quote-unquote freaky. Meet me there. And apparently you're supposed to bring tobacco and food donations for this mystic guy that traveled the country doing these processes. And it was called an Inipi, so not a sweat lodge, which is you.
What tribe was he? I mean, what tribe? What tribe he was?
I do, and I can't remember right now. It'll hopefully come to me during the story.
So where was the location again?
Lakota.
In Lakota.
So it was,
okay, that's
he was from the Midwest in the States. And there's very few, I don't even know if there's any more of them traveling and doing this anymore. They don't live a long time, the ones that do this, because this process that they go through is like going through the death and rebirth process, and it's physically and energetically hard on them. So the one that I know of.
Was this the guy that had the anterior fontanelle in his head that was unclosed? There was a Lakota medicine man that was that. Not that guy. Okay.
Nope.
See, I know my stuff on this. Okay. Keep going, girl.
We're
going to
get
all
there.
Right. I'm listening.
Now, remember, this is my direct experience. So I go knowing nothing. I showed up with a loaf cake and a pack of smokes. Apparently, that's not what you're supposed to do.
You're invited. No, okay. You didn't show up with, like, Cools, did you? Or Virginia Slims.
It may have been. I literally had a pack of smokes.
Virginia Slims. I think you'll like these. Or Tipperillos. Yeah. That's what Ingo Swan smoked, Tipperillos. Yeah.
Well, it was weird. It was the wrong thing anyway, but, you know, meant well, right? Coming from the right place.
I know.
So I get there, and it's some weird building.
A clue for
it's
you
like,
next time when you go do this. Bring a bag of – just bring a bag of tobacco. Like, there's a tobacco that you can buy that's just a tobacco. It actually has an Indian on it with a full headdress.
Yeah. I know which one
you
mean.
It's a very – bring that. There you go. Whatever that is, since they're not paying us to talk about them, that is what you bring. You bring that because they will go, And you say yatahe, yatahe. Yeah, so, you know.
I will say that I was the only one there with a pack of smokes. But anyway.
Well, good for you. I'm sorry I keep interrupting. I'm just trying to be funny.
So was that a weird situation? So it was all comfort zone shit, right? So first of all, it was the only white person there, I think, except for the Olympian skier. So the Olympian skier was there. How that all connected, I don't know. Anyway, so Bag of Smokes, Loaf Cake showed up, and it's in a back alley in North Vancouver, going into this room that I think where they had AA meetings or something. And so we pack in there. And so they start, I mean, we're just sitting there and sitting there, sitting there and sitting there and sitting there, because it's just all these people were packing in this little room. And while they're packing in this room, I mean, I don't know, I have no idea how much time, it was a lot before they even started. And I'm watching them set up the sacred, this is not like the touristy Indian stuff that you see. This is the real shit, like bones and organs and all kinds of dead animals.
It's not moccasin keychains and things like that, you mean?
I mean, I was seeing the real stuff.
It's real
stuff. And
So
they're setting up this massive altar. In a big square in the center of the room. The lady who was sitting next to me, I was kind of chatting, she was showing me how to smudge and stuff, and it turned out she was some sort of female elder woman of some...
Yeah, there's a name for that.
I can't remember what it was.
It's like a
I
can't remember. I'll remember it later. Okay.
Okay. Carrying on. So I'm sitting and chatting with her, and... on and on. I'm watching babies and children and all these, you know, indigenous people packing in the room. And then I'm seeing this huge band, like native band of drums and, you know, well, they're all drums, setting up around the altar. And then this, the medicine man who was, I almost remembered his name, something bear. Once they were getting ready to start, they started tying him up in leather straps, and then they bound him, his entire body, more leather, like big leather blankets, and then they bound that with leather straps, and then just at that, I had no idea what the hell I was doing there, or what was going to happen, or anything at all, right, other than the Olympian skier said, this is cool, go check it out, and so I'm sitting there, and just at that moment, forgot to say, all this time while they're setting all this stuff up, they're covering and taping black garbage bags and duct tape. They were taping every possible entrance point for light and air, all the vents, all the windows, all the door cracks, everything. Like we were sealed up in plastic in there, right? And so hours went by setting this up. And just after they got him all tied up and bound up and retied and kind of laid him on the floor,
What again was being laid on the floor? I missed it.
The medicine man was being tied up, bound up, and then tied up more, and then laid off in the middle of this altar floor.
Petesanwen is by the name. Petesanwen is the name of the holy woman. Petesanwen.
Okay. So she.
I'm sure. Sorry to derail you again, but. Okay, I gotta say this. The reason they're sealing everything up is because they're cutting off the flow of oxygen, which means that in a given time, in a given time, what's going to start to happen is everybody is going to start to become hypoxic. And in hypoxia, you're going to do what? You start to hallucinate. All right, continue. Just going to put that in there.
David.
Go ahead, my dear, my divine woman. Go ahead.
Okay, now. So just before things started happening, and they started happening really fast and really big, the native woman kind of leans over and touches my leg and goes, just try not to freak out. And then right at that second, the lights went out, the band starts up loud as hell, and so much happened at once. It was, and you don't go hypoxia in 10 seconds and start hallucinating. That's impossible. It's just because the door was open.
But you said it took
hours
for them to set it up.
Yeah, but the door was open the whole time. The door was open the whole time.
Okay, so fresh air supply until not. All right,
well,
got it.
you don't instantly go into hypoxia and hallucinate fully in 10 seconds. You just don't. The first thing that happened to me was there's some sound playing. Hang on. Oh, there we go. Okay. Mystical sound coming in. All right.
The washer is done. I have my washer and dryer connected to my phone, and so every time they stop, I'm talking to somebody, and all of a sudden I hear this stupid tune because this notice comes up. I'm like, damn it. And it goes on for like 30 seconds. You know, it's the most horrible tune. It's like, who the hell picked the tune for this, you know, washer dryer? And, you know, that are Wi-Fi connected. Anyway, go ahead.
That
so you got a sound. I'm still okay. Claiming hypoxia, but go ahead. All right.
Telling you, the door was open the whole friggin' time. The second the door closed and then the lights went out and they started playing, boom. I've never experienced this except in sweat lodges where I go through this process of having to surrender to being there. I like completely freaked out to the point where I was telling the person I was with, I can't stay. I've got to go right now, yelling in his ear. Like, I'm going to be in a coal-shaped hole on the wall. Like, I cannot. It didn't make sense. It wasn't logical. And then once I got through that, a few minutes later, I'm literally seeing spirits, balls, energy of light coming in the room, flying around, rattles, the lights, like fireworks inside these rattles that were on the altars lighting up. And jumping around, I could see giant wings flapping. I could see the entire illuminated silhouettes of all the people in the room with these flashing. It's so hard to describe.
How many people were there? How many people were there?
Oh, Jesus, I don't even know.
Like 50? 100?
It was a really small room, and I would guess 100.
Okay, small room, 100 people. It only takes 4 minutes to consume enough oxygen per person in a small confined space to reach a state of hypoxia. Oh, I got to say it, Nicole. I love you dearly. I have to say it. So what are the symptoms of hypoxia? What starts to happen to you when you start to get into a hypoxia?
I'm guaranteeing you.
Okay. I believe you in your heart that you believe that. Okay, my dear. Keep going. Sorry.
Okay.
Going to be the anchor here. You're going to have to drag me along on this.
Well, this is only something you can get on board with when you experience. Do you remember that that not so amazing Randy? That depressed little magician that would run around and tell people, you know, I'll pay you $1 million.
That lied to federal investigators and fraudulently filled out forms for his gay lover that he brought out, that came out of wherever he came out of.
Did he do that? Oh my God.
Yes, he was up on charges for fraud. A guy who made his living as one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. He loved saying that. Him, Joe Nickell, Michael Shermer, and Ray Hyman. These guys made their livings running around and denouncing people like you and people who listen to your show. They destroyed their lives for a living. Yeah.
Well, he went
after me.
He
did that.
For a period.
He was a closet. He was never graduated from high school, became a stage magician. Yeah, he went to like a sophomore in high school, and never went back. Never got educated beyond that. Became a stage magician. Yes. And he was a closeted gay guy, which I don't give a shit about that. My point is that that's what he was. So that's kind of strange. But for a guy who's destroying people for not telling the truth, according to him. And then, yes, he had a gay lover that he met somewhere, somehow, who was a Latino man from, let's just say, El Salvador. I don't really actually know where it was. But, Randy, the amazing Randy, falsified government documents to get his lover to be able to stay with him. And then, of course, when he realized that he was actually going to go, possibly go to prison, him and his gay lover, for what he was doing, he got enough friends together to sponsor a documentary to try to, you know, change the tide of, oh, well, you know, he was oppressed because he was gay. It was, he needed to seek asylum because he was gay. And then, of course, they investigated that and came back and went, actually, no, that's not the case. You were just trying to get him here, and you were willing to lie about it. So, yeah.
Well, he was a very sad little man, and he came after me, you know. Do you remember my spoon-bending kits?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which are still online, by the way, spoonbendingkits.com. And
get them, because I've seen her do it, and I've seen Yuri do it.
Well, anybody can do it, but this is the whole point, is that you can't believe in it unless you have your direct experience. So he came after me saying, yeah, I'll give you $1 million if you can prove it. And I'm like, put your damn wallet away. I'll give it to you for free and just do it. And then you know what we're talking about. Like,
do you know how many of those jackasses that are out there? There's actually $49.5 million out there being offered by skeptics. Do you think in God's name that any skeptic would ever go turn around and watch you bend the spoon like a guy like Randy and go, you convinced me? I mean, it's like, right? No, it's never going to happen. So anybody listening, if you ever are confronted by one of these jackasses, just, you know, grin at them and walk away, because Randy's perspective on life, he's dead now, but his perspective on life when he was alive was everything's a trick. Everything's an illusion.
If you say
you can do a certain thing, what he will do is he'll turn around, scratch his little head, and go, let's figure out how to do an illusion to replicate what Nicole says she's doing. And therefore, because I can create an illusion to replicate it, what she's doing is bullshit. Because here's what she's doing. She's doing this illusion that I just did, and I just made this up. Disjointed thinking. It's incorrect thinking. I have no more respect for him than anything.
Yeah, and I literally said to him, what a sad life he must live to be in that hate-filled box, you know, of disempowerment. I mean, you're missing the whole point entirely. But this is what ties into this, is that this piece is a piece of it, is the direct experience piece that where there was, it's not just what I saw or thought I saw. It's the what feeling came through, what messages came through with it that were relevant and correct, and what followed me home and never left and has been, that piece has been guiding me.
But what was that? I know I keep interrupting you, but what was that that shifted you?
Well, number one, as I learned to be more open and get out of my journalist brain, because, you know, like you, I always wanted, well, you know, the 3D, you know, simple facts laid out so it's nice and comfy and I don't have to, you know, take any risks or be uncomfortable to stretch and learn, right? And so I had to have the direct experience of seeing, knowing, and hearing. It was like, it took a long time, like layers of understanding, kind of like when Daniel was talking about his experiences back in the day. And he didn't have all the, you know, summary of the meaning until many years later, right? When it's experiential, it takes a while to kind of understand. But when I came home that night, I was like, well, I was weird, you know, kind of going back to self. And I had set all these candles around. I was going to have a bath and go to bed. And I literally could feel that I was not alone. Got out of the bath, got the hell out of there. And I've never been disconnected from whatever that energy is. It literally gives me messages to this day. But again, that's not something that you can prove on a piece of paper. It's experiential and it's direct so that I know, but that's as far as it goes until you have your experience.
Well, you know the experience, but you don't know if it's real or not.
When you're having a direct experience, you do know, because there's a, like I said, there's the relation to what's happening. There's different levels. Let me use an example, David. When you were shot right, with that in the bullet going in the helmet, and you had your experience with an angel telling you where you were on the wrong path.
Yeah, but I also know that what I do, you're correct, yes. But I have always explained that in a terms of, I don't know what that was. Mm-hmm. As years have gone by, I have concluded, based on my experience, that what that was me talking to me. But back when I had no reference for it and it just suddenly happened, did I know it happened? Yeah, I know it happened. Did I know what it was? I have never said ever that I know what it was because I didn't know what it was. I believed what it was because I believed it. You know, I know it happened to me, and therefore I believed what I was describing to people because I know I had the experience. But I never have said to people, I know that was real. That was, I know that was an entity. I know that was something. And I've never, in the years that I've been teaching as a remote viewer, I've never had an experience of something like that where I could come back and say, empirically, I know. Right, I have irrefutable, undeniable evidence of I know that. What I know is that you and I are connected. What I know is that we are omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, eternal beings. That's what I know.
Yeah.
I know that from physics. I know that from experience. I know that from the, doing the work in the physical and the non-physical. But there are so many things with that, you know, that we are asked to come into our experience Rolodex, that we just have to look at them and say, I know that happened, but I don't know what that was.
Yeah,
and
I want to be
know
clear.
If it was real.
Yeah, and I want to be clear. That's what I am saying as well. I'm not actually putting any story or meaning in particular. I just know that that was part of that real connection beyond mind. It was beyond, you know, beliefs at the time, and it connected me to something bigger, but it was real.
Sure. And that's fair. I get that. So
cool.
Where were you doing? You were doing this north of Vancouver. But you don't remember the First Nation people that were doing it.
So I'm pretty sure it was Lakota. I think his name was Running.
I don't think Lakota are up there. Lakota or Sioux?
No.
They're part of southwestern United States.
Yeah, it was from the Midwest in the U.S. And this one guy, there's very few people that do Indians. And so this one guy was traveling around, you know, in the States and Canada, and I don't think beyond.
They call them, do you want to know what their slang is for those guys? The Lakota, Dakota, Kakota, there's a whole bunch of them. But they're called roadmen. They're called a roadman. These people that travel to do these kinds of ceremonial things, they're called a roadman. They have terms for all these people. Yeah.
Very few of them do Inipis, and I don't even know if there are very many anymore. It was, I guess, not something you can just, you know, phone up your local, you know, reservation.
Roadman Incorporated, yeah.
Yeah.
Roadman will travel. I will be there to do your shamanic. They don't call them shaman. That world, they're called medicine men. There's a name for like a medicine woman. There's a name for. There's a category called a holy man. There's a category called holy woman. And then it goes into these other the road men, which are road women. And they're more clearly in that society, more road men than road women, more holy men than women, more holy, you know, more medicine men than women. But, what we need to do is get on the show, Kenny. We need to get Kenny, the doc medicine man, to talk to you about these things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, the main
fun.
Point of this was, again, through my direct experience, because I wouldn't have that belief if I didn't have my direct experience. It would have just been like, oh, okay, interesting, right? I don't know. But what I learned from that was to pay attention to indigenous rituals and that to know that something was legitimately there at the base of some of these stories and experiences.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I do. I agree. I would never argue with that. I mean, and you use the right terminology, belief as opposed to knowing. I mean, you know in your heart, but you have no empirical evidence of what you saw. And you were opposed to me giving the scientific qualifications for what was happening. there's a reason why people, I know that the medicine man was saying, oh, we're going to seal out the bad spirits, seal in all the good spirits and intention.
Oh, no, they didn't even explain anything. No, I didn't know what the hell was happening.
Which is, okay. So in my scientific mind, if I was standing there next to you, I'd be going, what they're going to freaking do to us right here is they're starving the oxygen in the room. I don't give a damn. If it's a small room and there's 100 people in there, it takes 4 minutes for each person to consume the oxygen in a confined space. 4 minutes. Which means that, is it instantaneous? No. But do they close the door and allow a few minutes to elapse so everyone becomes hypoxic? Goddamn, yes, they are. That's the only reason that they are doing that. And the same thing happens in the sweat lodge. Fire consumes oxygen. You're in a sweat lodge, and if there are coals that are there, which typically there aren't, the coal fire is outside. They bring the hot rocks in. So they bring the hot rocks in, which which causes the oxygen moles to accelerate in their movement. And you probably consume, in a place like that where they're superheated, you can consume more moles of oxygen than you normally would outside. So people become hypoxic. And one of the symptoms of hypoxia is the deeper it goes, the more you start to hallucinate. Now, look. Am I saying that that's a bad thing? No, I'm saying that explains what's happening to people. Is it a spiritual experience? It is to the person that's experiencing it, I guess. But is it a true spiritual experience? I don't know. Right? I don't know the answer to that.
As soon as they
opened the door and you started breathing oxygen again, you'd recover fairly quickly. It's not like it lasts with you for days or even hours,
lasted with me for quite some time, and in some ways, indefinitely. Have you ever been to a sweat lodge, David?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I talked about one last night. I was doing sweat lodges at the Omega Institute, and when I was single, I was going there, and I thought it was a cool thing because I was doing the sweat lodges with, like, the employees of the Omega Institute. So I was, in my, God, how old was I? I was, like, when I first did it, I was probably, like, 50, 40, maybe 48, 47. And I'm doing sweat lodges naked with, like, 21-year-old people. They were all hippies. Like, all the guys were dreadlocks and stuff like that, but.
Was this a real sweat lodge that was led by
Well, what does that mean?
Well, it's
well,
very.
What does that mean? You mean like like the white guy in Arizona that killed a bunch of people? You know,
he claimed to have been
trained as a shaman. That guy?
Yeah, no. What I mean is indigenous people that have come up through their paths, and those are the ones that are spiritual.
No, there were no holy men. No holy women. No medicine.
Doesn't count.
This was a hippie sweat lodge, and I did probably four of them. So I got in the hippie sweat lodge, and I'm there. It's uncomfortable. My back hurts because my spine was at that point collapsing even then, and I'm like, my back hurts. I'm sitting here, my ass is in the dirt. I'm naked. I'm sweating. People next to me. Girls or no girls are dripping sweat all over me. A lot of those folks didn't bathe regularly, so it was starting to be like, which is worse? The lack of oxygen, the heat, or the odor of the sweat, a body odor. And a spiritual experience for me, no. It was an exercise in being capable of enduring the discomfort of being there.
You were
That's
literally missing the key element, and there's nothing spiritual about that kind of process, so I would invite you to be open to an actual
dirty sauna. So I would ask people, be careful, be discerning, don't just go do a dirty sauna because you think it's going to be cool. You are correct, and I agree with you. If it's not if it's not set in the correct intention, if it's not given the correct energy, if all of the people are not prepared to do it, and if they are not doing it with purpose, right? Doing it with purpose and doing it with intention, then it's just a waste of your time, and you should not do it. You should not engage in something like that. That's like flying to Peru to, you know, do something with an ayahuasca arrow, you know, to go in and step in so you can say, yeah, I went to Peru and did ayahuasca. Yeah, that's ridiculous. Don't do that. It's become now, you know, ayahuasca has become a cottage industry in South America. And it used to be like had to select the perfect vine, you know, perfect age determined by diameter. Now, because they've got so many yuppies, you know what I mean by that, flying down there in freaking droves of people. There are no shaman have now taken their hands off and gone, not interested, not really. I mean, some of them are like, well, there's money to be made here and they're doing it. But most of them have not, which is why what you hear, the people that are managing this stuff are called ayahuascaros. That means basically ayahuasca cowboys, okay? That's what they are. They've got Uncle Juan's recipe, who got that from, Uncle Benito. And so they're pulling all this stuff, and they are now denuding this very sacred vine from these forests, these jungles. They're starting to run out of vine. Isn't that like the most crazy, understandable yet, world version of this stuff? This was a sacred, sacred rite, a sacred medicine, a sacred, vine that grew. And they only harvested certain vines because they had to have been, they had to be a certain kind and dimension, and it had to be, capable of serving as the spiritual medicine that they wanted. And now they've gone through all that shit, so now it's becoming, you've got guys down there like trying to cultivate these vines. So now we're getting an industrial-grade ayahuasca down there. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening. And and all the spiritual purpose behind it has now just been commercialized, and people are listening, and they're going down there. They're thinking they're going to go have this great, spiritual awakening. That's not what that is. If you don't have a spiritual intention and purpose, and if you're not being guided spiritually to do it, and I mean really being guided to be spirit, and this is what I loved about the Dakota, medicine man talk last night. He goes, You're opening windows into another dimension. You're opening windows into a new understanding. Yes. If you are not prepared for that spiritually, intellectually, physically, emotionally, if you're not prepared for that, you're going to do damage. Nothing's going to happen something's going to happen that you are not ready for, and you're going to freak out, and that's why you've had some white guy killed a shaman, a female shaman down there, right? And then he was hacked to death by machetes from the people in the village because he killed their shaman. I mean, this is the crap that's going on down there now. So if you think you're going to go down there and have some tremendous spiritual experience through this commercialized cottage industry, governed by – there are gangs now that are controlling this stuff. So, folks, if you're listening, stay the hell away from that crap. It's not going to give you what you're asking for. And, and they go with different doses. There's no standardization. They harvest younger vines. They have less of the psychoactive ingredient in them. The old vines are no longer there. It was supposed to be something that was chosen for a purpose, for a medicine man to, purposely guide and lead and instruct. And now it's turned into, if we give you enough of this shit, you'll have a trip.
Yeah. And that, therein lies the example. What you've just outlined there, the differences between the real ayahuasca experience and the commercialized crap that's, you know, meaningless, that is the difference between your sweat lodge and a real sweat lodge and my Unipi experience, which was
I get it. I get it. I understand. I had no faith that this sweat lodge was going to be anything other than what it ended up being. Because, you know, it was a bunch of sweaty, naked bodies sitting in a lodge with their asses in the dirt. And as soon as I got into it, I was like, this is ridiculous. Why am I sitting here? I mean, I'm an airborne ranger. You know, I'm like, I've existed in misery for, you know, undetermined amounts of time. Why am I in here doing this? I really felt foolish for having done it. Now, just to show you how ridiculous I can possibly be, I did that like four times there. So you would have thought I would have learned my lesson, but no, I didn't. I went back four times and sat there. And I was the one guy that turned around and was like, can we bring towels? I mean, can we sit on a towel? I really don't want to get up out of here and, like, be, you know, digging dirt out of my ass crack while we get out of this place. I've had, you know, that kind of experience as a ranger, but I really don't want to do it right now. Plus, you look ridiculous when you step out of that and a bunch of naked bodies standing there. And you're the guy that's, like, trying to, you know, get a napkin. I'm sorry, folks. I'm being ridiculous, but I feel funny today. I've only had an hour of sleep since the last, 32 hours. So, I was on air last night till 4 in the morning.
Well, I hope, David, that you manifest a real experience along these lines. Perhaps Kenny will help. Let's have him on in the future.
I want to get Kenny on, but I also want you to know that I don't need that experience. I don't need it. I know where I stand. I know it. I know where I stand in, you know, the holographic matrix field. I know my purpose. I know my calling. I have my primary question, you know, confirmed for me, and I alter it occasionally. But I know what I'm doing in my life, and I mean, I love it that you and others continue to pursue all these things. I think it's amazing that you're doing that, but it's not for me. I mean, I'm never going to go do a sweat lodge like with. If Kenny invited me to go do it with all the elders, I swear to you, I would say no, because why? I don't really need it to awaken me to something else. So I feel secure where I am and what I know and what I know, and I don't espouse beliefs anymore. So. And whenever people do, like he actually did, his name is Kevin, actually. I screwed up his name. He did, and I was kind of inspired in the dialogue that we exchanged, you know, last night. But what started to happen is it started to get weird. And when it started to get weird and they started to talk about stuff that I knew as, you know, as a medical researcher, as a scientist, I was just like, why does it always have, and I said that to the moderators last night, you know, I was typing, I go, why do they always have to do it? Why do they always have to push it the limits on this? Why can't, you know, he started off as this humble, spiritual, you know, medicine man guy that was really genuine and honest, and people were enthralled listening to him. They were just, you know, the numbers of people were just popping up because people back-channeled other people and go, you got to come to this room and listen to this. And the room was swelling. And he was interesting to talk to. He had a good sense of humor. I really liked it. Until some other person came in, and then he connected with this other person. You know, understand what I mean? This other person came in, and she was extraordinarily esoteric and kind of way off the baseline of human reality, right? And then he started to gravitate over there. And I was like, Kenny, you know, you stop talking about it because, you know, if you guys had all this stuff you're saying you had, I mean, if you can truly heal people spiritually, if you can take tumors out of people, if you can do those things, I mean, all right, good. I'm all support. I will say it to the
you know, to anybody in the world, but you just have to prove it to me. And so far, all proof has been disappointing. It's not been existence. And you know me. You know that if it was real, you know that I would not hesitate to say it. I would turn right around, and I would broadcast it to any and every place that I could broadcast it. But all I've been is disappointed in it.
It's just beginning.
Yes.
And I think that the universe has paired us up for a reason, and that you're being gently coddled to perhaps new levels. But we'll see.
And
time
you
will
have
tell.
Been gently, you're being aggressively coddled. to seeing life through a more focused lens. just kidding. I don't want you to change. I just want to be. What I really love about our relationship is that you get to be what you want to be, and I get to be what I want to be, and that's the coolest that can possibly ever exist, right? I don't want to change you. I don't want to change anybody. I just want to say what I need to say about these things. People can take it or not, and I'm not about changing people like that.
Well, the name of the show, Open Search Outward, we're searching, we're open, and I've got to run because my second born is on her way over for birthday time with me, so I must run.
Christine,
but next time,
who is it again? Which one? Oh,
Brianda.
Okay.
Brianda.
Brianda.
The Earth Angel one.
This is the one that I always knew who was really friendly with me. Was it Christina or Brianda?
Christina is the older one.
Yeah.
Yep. So on that
where
note,
where is she now?
She
Go
is.
Ahead. And,
she's still in the area around, but she's on doing her thing.
As young people do.
They do. But let's do our thing next week, Saturday, 1 o'clock Pacific.
Are we going to do 2 hours or one? You just cut my whole thought process short at 1 hour.
It's so hard to jam you into 1 hour. So let's go free-flowing next week, whatever time you want.
Okay. What do you want to talk about next week? Anybody know?
Yeah,
maybe your,
figure it out in the moment.
The higher headquarters up there know what they want to talk about. You want to talk about the Illuminati? You want to talk about Masonic ritual? You want to talk about, I don't know, you want to talk about medical miracles? You want to talk about, I got it all. So I'm prepared.
All right. Let's be in the moment. See what comes up as we did today, which was perfect. David, I love you. You take care. Get some
love
sleep.
You too. I'm going to try, yeah.
All right.
We're wound up right now. Love you, my dear.
See you next week, David.
All right. Good night.
Open Search Outward.
Bye,
we are here Saturdays, 1 p.m. Pacific, and we're going to be right back with more right after this quick reset break.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
You're listening to News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained since January 1997. We began our 25th year in broadcasting in January 2022, and we're just getting started. Exploring the edge of human consciousness and possibility on planet Earth with founder and journalist Nicole Marie Whitney at the helm. What's really real and what's really possible? That is what we want to know. Join us at newsforthesoul.com. Newsforthesoul.com.
Previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
And And it is Saturday, 1 p.m.-ish Pacific time. Heavy on the ish. And we are now connected. We're now live. It's time for Open Search Outward. I just realized we don't have our fancy schmancy intro set up yet. Perhaps by next week. I'm sure it will involve lots of reverb and echo on the outward, outward, outward.
I can hum a song or something.
And, yeah, I think so. Yeah, it'll be neat. We'll see what they turn out next week. Meanwhile, that's Dave, former CIA remote viewer and guest on this show for a life sentence at this point, about 25 years.
Since 1997. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Really need to do the ticker tape parade. And me, Nicole from News for the Soul. All right, so we are here, as the intro had said, we've been on a quest here for that long to find out what's really real, what's really possible. And together, we search those possibilities and potentials and apparently debunk a whole lot of crap along the way on the show.
Did I pop a bubble?
You popped a bubble. But I'm not letting it go. So we'll talk about that one later. Yeah. Anyway. You know the yeah. No, later. Okay. So, Dave, what's new?
Yes. Well, we just finished a really fun clubhouse meeting. You know, I do these marathon talks all night on Clubhouse on Fridays, and we had a fun one last night. We did Synchrodestiny, and we were going to do the show with Michael Nitti, who's my really good friend for many, many years. And Michael had some amazing Synchrodestiny stories he was going to start. He's a platinum and lion life coach for Tony Robbins and others, and he has been, he also has his own private clients. Just really amazing client list. They will never let you say the names of people, but these are people that you see on screen, people, right, you know, that are running big industries, and, you know, he is the coach for them, right, or for their wives or something. Whatever is needed. It's interesting. You know, people are extraordinarily successful, but they can't keep a relationship, or, you know, they are extraordinarily successful, but their employees hate them, or they're extraordinarily successful and, you know, they don't know what to do next, those kinds of things. So he is one of many that are really skilled at that level. And he's extraordinarily loved by his clients. But what I wanted to do with him is to have him tell Synchrodestiny stories, because he's got a zillion of them. And if I, you know, had a couple, I'd throw them in. But I was explaining the quantum mechanical interpretations of Synchrodestiny, why that is from a scientific perspective. And also, not debunking. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, how do you define synchrodestiny?
Yeah, well, synchrodestiny is a creation. The term was created, coined, you know, kind of owned by Deepak Chopra. And he started, you know, wrote his synchrodestiny books, and he was doing synchrodestiny classes. And, you know, to give you an example of what it is, I mean, there are a number of people that kind of commonly refer to it as strange coincidences that you're meant to recognize. Strange coincidences that you're meant to recognize. Carl Jung said strange coincidences that with a spooky aspect that you are meant to recognize. I thought that was clever. Spooky aspect. That was Jung. So Deepak, of course, brought it out of that and defined it much, you know, in the same way, but wanted to give stories. So what I have is a story about that. This will illustrate it for you. So Michael, he got sick and he's in hospital and he's not getting out till tomorrow. So he wasn't on the show last night. So I callously stole his story, told it last night in his absence, so I could use it because you weren't there. You got sick. That's your fault. So the story was this: he was the director of operations at Tony Robbins. And Tony Robbins was kind of, the whole Robbins corporation was kind of run like a family. And he gets with this like huge business consultant guy that you would know the name if I could remember it right now. But he's a huge successful, it's like the Warren Buffett of business design and management. And he convinces Tony that he's running his company like a family. He needs to run it like a business. So Tony being Tony goes, yeah, okay. Well, tell me what I need to do. This is the start of the Synchrodestiny story, so you can understand how it works.
Okay.
So this guy says, I'm going to send you a new vice president who will come in here and shake this all up and structure it like a corporation and run it like a corporation as it should be run. So this woman is taken from this guy's staff and is migrated laterally over to Tony's staff and comes in, and she was really aggressive. And one of the things that she started doing was looking at husband-wife teams in the company. Well, Mike, of course, and his wife, Julia, they're in the company. And so what happens is this woman decides, well, look, Mike, you can't have this. So one of the two of you are going to have to go. So Michael says, look, I want to be a good soldier and play along on this. I don't want to fight you on it. So there are some openings over at Deepak. Let's say what if Julie goes, you know, my wife goes over to work at Deepak. Is that okay? And then I can stay here in my current position. And the decision was yes, so she goes to Deepak, his wife. She's working with Deepak Chopra at the Chopra Center in La Costa, California. I can remember this. And then what happens is Deepak is introducing Synchrodestiny into his core POI lineup of things he talks about. So Michael goes to a Synchrodestiny lecture, class, whatever you want to call it. He's thinking to himself, this is amazing. You know, I'm in here. I'm here because my wife is here. I'm here because, you know, the woman, the new CEO said that she had to leave. So now I'm here, and I'm sitting here for a free class listening to Deepak. And there were only a couple of open seats. He goes and sits in a seat next to the aisle. There's one more seat right next to him. He notices a man standing in the back talking to some people. And he glances, and he thinks to himself, that's a familiar face. He sits down in his seat, and then 20 seconds later, this man comes over and sits down right next to him, looks at him and goes, hey. And then looks over at Deepak, because Deepak now goes, welcome everybody to Synchrodestiny. I want to, I want you all to give a round of applause to our special guest. And the man stands up and he says, I want him to share with you this Synchrodestiny story. So this man standing here in a dark suit, open collar, you know, tone on tone, looks out and says, yeah, I'm an actor. I just want you to know, I mean, yeah, you might recognize me, but I want you to know what my beginnings were like. You know, I wanted to be an actor. I studied to be an actor. I considered myself an actor. But for years, when I put myself out there after school and things, I couldn't get a part. I couldn't get an audition. Or if I did get the audition, the part was completely wrong and I never got it. So I was working all of these jobs, like, you know, bussing tables, being a waiter, janitorial stuff. I was doing that kind of thing just to, you know, pay for a one-room apartment and a one-room, you know, bungalow and food. You know, it was miserable. But I never lost sight. I never gave up the fact that I was an actor. I identified as an actor. I called myself an actor. I lived, you know, like an actor. I was constantly practicing my acting skills, even though nobody cared. So I'm walking down the street one day, and he goes, I don't quite remember where I was going, but there were people on the sidewalk with me, and suddenly there's a huge loud bang, and it's up above us. It's like somebody dropped something on a roof. So everybody just kind of stops and looks up because it was really loud. It caught everybody's attention. And as he's looking up, he says, I don't see what caused the noise, but I notice there's a window, and underneath the window there's a sign. And it's on the second story, not like down at the street level. I had to look up to see this. And it says Simmons and Company, established, and it gives his birth date. It's his birth date on the sign. And so he goes, that must mean something. You know, that must mean something. So he wanders around trying to find the entrance to this place. He beats on the door, and he goes, I beat on this door well past the point of any sane person staying here, because nobody was answering it. But he kept beating on the door because he was certain, you know, he's like, I've got to find this out because my birth date's on this building, on the, you know, under the window. Finally, an elderly woman cracks open the door and goes, yes, you know, with an agitated face. And he goes, I'm sorry, but I'm supposed to be here. I just feel like I'm supposed to be here. My birth date's on, you know, out there on the sign for your whatever this is. And she opens the door a little wider, and he looks in, and he goes, oh, he sees a man standing on a box, and a man is measuring a suit on him, and the man's wife is sitting next to him. And he looks around, and he goes, he can instantly tell this is an extraordinarily high-end tailor shop. He said, I looked over at a tuxedo that was on a mannequin, he goes, and it was really clear to me I could never afford not even a shirt out of this place. But I'm here because I'm supposed to be here. The woman keeps asking him, why are you here? I mean, what are you doing? What are you beating on the wall? He goes, I'm supposed to be here. She goes, you're not on the schedule. You have to have an appointment to be here. No, you're not supposed to be here. He goes, no, I'm supposed to be here. I'm telling you. And she goes, well, what are you doing? What are you? And he says, I'm an actor. Like that. All animated, you know, big smile on his face. The man standing on the box being fitted for a suit says, because obviously at this point, everybody stopped, turned, and they're looking at him. And the man on the box goes, well, I'm a Hollywood director. And he goes, come on over here. And so he takes out a card. He hands it to this man, and he says, that was pretty impressive, what you just did in the doorway. And he said, here's my card. Go down to this studio, down to this theater group. He said, you find the director that's there. Here's her name. You tell her that I gave you this card and that I said for her to find something for you to do there. He goes, now listen to me. It may just be painting props for the next 3 years, but you need to be willing to pay that price, because if you'll do that, if you'll pay that price and live that life, eventually you will obtain what it is that you want to obtain. He goes down, thanks the man very much, thanks the elderly couple, apologizes to the wife, heads on down the street, goes straight to that theater company and walks in and goes, hey, here's who I am, here's a card, this gentleman and I just talked. He said that I should talk to you about getting a position here, and you know, he said you would do that. I'll take anything. So the director of this theater company gives him some, you know, menial task to do, but they're holding tryouts for the next, you know, for their next performance. And so he tries out. He does the audition. He gets the part. It's a lead. And from that point forward, Gerald Butler becomes the A-list actor that you now know him to be, right?
Wow.
Gerard Butler. Yeah, crazy story, right?
Wow.
Gerard, yeah, I always mispronounce it. that was the synchrodestiny story that Deepak wanted presented to start off his seminar on synchrodestiny. And I got interested in that to say, because Mike and I were going, I was going to now try to explain the science of that. And I started looking around, and as typically, you know, I find all these different interpretations of synchrodestiny. I find people that go through these elaborate processes of, oh, there's seven kinds of, you know, synchros or synchrodestinies. You know, there's the deviation synchrodest, this deviation sync. There's the, you know, precursor sync. There's the post sync. There's all, they go through all this stuff, and I've actually read through it all. And then I think to myself, well, that just muddies the water for everybody, doesn't it? I mean, it not anywhere in there does it say what does synchrodestiny mean? They pitch it, they're presenting it like it's just crap that happens and you just go for the ride kind of thing. And it's not that. There was no input and no teaching into how is it that these coincidences that you're supposed to pay attention to actually occur. Well, you know the answer to this because you've heard me talk about it 1,001 times. You know, it's all about how you're resonating in the moment, right? It's mm-hmm. all about the energy that you're putting into your life in the moment, the energy that's a positive, you know, directed, focused, uplifting energy. You know, Gerard Butler could have walked around with his tail between his legs, slinking around because he's a failed actor, right? And all he's doing is picking up other people's dirty dishes or delivering their food and handing them a check. Or he took on the perspective that he did moment to moment to moment to moment of his life. He walks down the street, hears a noise, looks up, sees a sign, sees his birthday up there, and accepts that out of his positive attitude in the moment. He didn't say what a depressed, failed actor would say, which was, okay, so what, that's my birthday. That's weird, and walk down the street. He, again, in that moment, followed that trail because that was the kind of energy that he was putting into his life. And look where that takes him, sequence after sequence after sequence after sequence. But he was in control of it every second of every moment, wasn't he?
So literally a raising of the frequency?
What's that?
So it was literally the raising of his frequency, period?
Well, his frequency is probably better just expressed as his resonance. He was upbeat, positive. He never gave up on what he wanted to be, what he felt his purpose in this life was. He didn't let external things, sway him from that particular path. It's the kind of stuff that Werner Erhard, taught so much that people often didn't understand, which, was like the Landmark Forum and things. You know, people go into Landmark Forum and I know because I was there. Patty tricked me into it one time. And I was one of the people that was easily irritated because I didn't get it. You know, I didn't understand it, what they were trying to do. And there's a skillful approach that they go for in that, which is, that people will say, well, can we take a break? And the facilitator will say, well, no, we really feel that this is important. We would like you to stay and we would like to continue. And then people will get irritated by that. Another hour goes by, and somebody will say, look, we need to have a break and have a bathroom break. And the facilitator will say, we'd really like to continue. We feel that the content here is very important. We don't want to miss anything. And they get more irritated. And pretty soon, if somebody will stand up and they head for the door, and there will be a staff member standing at the door that will say, we would really like you to stay because we feel that, what's going on in here is important. We don't want you to miss anything. And people then accuse them of, like, preventing them from going to the bathroom and stuff. They get completely irate, unhinged. And here's the deal. I mean, I can save you all the price of a Landmark Forum. What they're presenting to people is it's how you're reacting to the moment. We're not going to stop you from going out. All we're doing is saying that we think the content's important and we would like you to stay. That doesn't mean you can't leave. You see what I mean? People can get up and go and talk to the staff member can say that and you could say, okay, yeah, but I'll be right back and go pee and then come back into the seminar. But people start accusing them of locking them in the room and this anger just flourishes and it spreads like a cancer across the room. And it's amazing to see it. And I went through the whole day just being all pissed off. I mean, literally pissed off, frustrated. People controlling my life, telling me what I have to do and can't do. And the truth of it is they weren't doing any such thing. That was the energy, the emotion that I was putting into that. So The whole point of Werner Erhard's teachings was simply that your life is moment to moment what you choose to make it or what you choose to layer onto it. You can choose promise, possibility, living as the observer, living an authentic life, resonating powerful, believing in your purpose and believing in your calling and et cetera. Or you can live your life pissed off, reacting to what people are saying or doing. And what you recognize is that you have to recognize that you must own that. That's what they call your stuff in the landmark form. That's your stuff. That's your story, right? And it's amazing when the light bulb comes on in your head, because the rest of the seminar then becomes something quite emotional just in terms of watching people when that come to that, that they have themselves assigned all of this negativity to their life and embraced that and used it to define their life. In this idea of synchrodestiny, it is how it's not just a roller coaster ride of things happening because they're happening. You know, it is something that you are very much in charge of. You can absolutely be in charge of that, and you can create those patterns of potentials that you would start to call coincidences that should be recognized. But those patterns of potentials occur because of how you're resonating in the moment, how you are resonating in the moment, how you are thinking, being, acting, right? Inculcating the positive promise and possibility in your life, or sitting back and, you know, casting doubt, shadow, anger, you know, finality, it's over, I'm a failure, I can't do this, I can't do that. Then, you know, there are people who are teaching synchrodestiny incorrectly, in my opinion, who are basically then going to say, okay, great, you just take your hands off the handlebars of your life, and now I'll tell you, you know, what the precursor synchros are and the deviation synchros, and I'll tell you how the world, right, which is called the change distribution, right, meaning the collective moment, all the different moments impacting us, take your hands off steering wheel of your life and then watch what happens. Yeah, damn tootin', you know, it'll take you on some vortex ride through all different kinds of things, and, you know, and you may notice that you may not, but some people have done that, have come to that point.
Oh,
Butler
yeah.
did not, you know. He did not,
so,
nor did you, nor have I.
There's two points coming to me. Firstly, the visual of Dave pissed off, arms folded at an S seminar. Hilarious.
mm-hmm.
Secondly, there's another aspect. There's another aspect to this, though, because I get the link in frequency. Definitely hands remain on handlebars, for the love of God. But there's another aspect to this. Like, as you were telling the story of the boom at the right moment in the right spot on the sidewalk and the sign in the right place at the boom in the right, and then the connection to recognize, oh, that's my birthday, and then the connection to recognize, oh, that means something, I'm supposed to be in there. But not like there's, and I know you're going to be all over this, but there's a divine intervention aspect to this. Like, what are the odds of all that, right? In that moment.
Yeah, I'm
here we
right.
go.
I see. Well, you have to understand that I gave up on this idea of the divine. You know, after 35 years as a high priest in the Mormon Church and serving at the levels that I served, and then seeing and understanding the pablum that organized religion became in my mind, that I felt hypocritical in saying the things that I said and standing in the role that I stood in, you know, as a first counselor in a state presidency and second counselor in a bishopric, kept passing judgment on people for all manner of things, you know, voting to excommunicate people. And all the while standing up and saying the things that I said, like that I, you know, I've heard the word of God, or that, you know, I've received revelation and this and that. I never did. I was just making it up. I was doing what was expected of me and playing the part. And so I never saw God. I never saw any of those divine things. So where I'm at with that is when you say divine to me, I have to look at my life in, you know, working and studying in that role, because even when I was at BYU, every semester at BYU had to take a religion class. You could take religions of the world and this and that. It wasn't LDS religion. You could any kind of religion class. So I always did. So you really kind of come out with a sort of a semi-scholar in theology, right? Depending on how deep you want to go with some of the stuff. And you start finding out things about how the Bible was really written. You start finding out things about evidences for Christ, and you find out that, you know, the evidences against outweigh the evidences for. You start to see these things being asked to be accepted on a basis of faith, which to me is like a, that's like a no-win, you know, game of you have to accept it on faith. You have to believe it sight unseen, and if you don't believe it sight unseen, then you're not going to get the reward at the end. So
to me
is difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. You got to stop connecting those two things, man-made stuff, and we're going to get mail. But, I mean, I don't associate any man-made religion with my direct experiences with this unseen thing that I've had very – I mean, we wouldn't be sitting here talking.
Well, what do you think the source
excited.
Of it is?
Well, I don't know. That's why I do the show.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I'm talking about the real thing, not anything to do with theological study. That's the opposite direction to me. That's just like those people trying to break down the different levels of the synchrodestiny and get all fiddle-farty in the way and mess the whole thing up, right? So
yeah, they're creating a belief structure around something they're coming up with selling it on YouTube.
Get in the way. Yeah, no, I'm talking about the real thing. And I think this is why we balance each other out on this search that we're taking together.
Yeah, of course it is.
You know, like, look at what happened when we were naming the show. Love Dave, he's like a walking thesis guy, right? He sent me this long attachment with all these potential names that I kind of glazed over. And I tuned in to my invisible, weird, divine intervention team that got me on my path. Immediately thought, no, it's open search outward. It sort of reminded me a bit about, Nimoy show earlier. What was that called? It was something search. It just reminded me of that, and then it tied it in to remote viewing, and it felt powerful. And
is it Leonard Nimoy? Leonard Nimoy?
Yeah, he did a search something in the 70s, exploring the unknown. So it tied it in with that, with what we do, with who you are, with what I'm doing. And it was just one thing. And that was downloaded from the upstairs team, as I put it. Like, that, you know, that wasn't me researching. I didn't Google anything, right? So what's that, Dave?
In Search Of, that was the name of the show.
Ah, In Search Of, yeah. There you go. Oh, I love that show.
Yeah. 76 to 82.
Yeah. You're
well,
on Google now, aren't you?
I truly appreciate and love the fact that you have a belief in divine intervention of things.
It's not a belief; it's a direct experience.
I know, but it's a direct experience that. and where I am with it is, I'm cool with that, and I appreciate that people have that. I'm not an atheist. And I'm not really an agnostic at all. What I believe is that the eternal and the divine, the omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent aspect is us, each of us, that we were gifted with that ability. And what I keep asking and putting out there is, just think, if all of us born into this existence were gifted with that ability, and we were, why were we gifted with that ability, and who gifted it to us? It boils right down to passages of the Old Testament, which speaks to the free agency of humanity, the free agency meaning that we are here to, you know, given these gifts, and we were supposed to be using these gifts to exercise our free agency to live rightly. And we became such a, you know, we immediately fell into the things that we that drive us even to this day, you know, greed and war and murder and, you know, secularism and so forth. And it was a creation of us. I've never, ever, you know, turned around when somebody would say, well, you know, why doesn't God stop this? I would look at people and go, if there's a God, God has nothing to do with this. You know, God is not starting war and he's not stopping war, if that, or he or she, but whatever you want to look at it. That was not in the formula. You know, we created this. We did this to each other. We decided, you know, what was important enough to us to kill and butcher and maim. We did that, not God. God had nothing to do with it. So when you talk divine, I love hearing it come from you. And it softens my heart to know that you, as wonderful a person as you are, that you have that attachment to the divine. I need to try to figure out, you know, what that is and where we came from and why we were put here and why we were given these gifts we were given, and then why what we did as soon as we possibly could was to create stories and belief structures, false stories and belief structures that took those abilities away from us and then told us that these things unseen that we have to accept on a basis of faith, that they have, they are the divine. They are omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. They are eternal. And you have to live rightly here following our edicts, right? You will never attain that.
That's the opposite of divine.
Well, yeah. I mean, but that, you see, that was my life, that's how I grew up. That's how I was, you know, that's how I grew up as a young man, experiencing that and being, you know, buying it hook, line, and sinker for many, many years, and then coming to this realization after being trained as a remote viewer that, yeah, that's not, I can't accept that anymore. So I don't know how or why there would be divine intervention in the path of each human. I do understand or accept that in the path of life of each human, that it is how that human chooses to live, how they choose to resonate, how they choose to serve, how they choose to contribute, how they choose to fulfill other, you know, human needs. But the top needs, you know, the things that are most fulfilling are the things that are contributing, giving back to the society, to the global society, to the human race, giving service to fellow humans and to the human race, doing those things, filling your heart with love and compassion, giving up the requirement to be right. Those are the kinds of things that I believe are our responsibility moment to moment. And I do love you that you come up with, that you throw something out there like the divine, because for me I don't understand where it would come from and why it would influence. I mean, I appreciate the fact that you feel it does, but I don't understand it, why it would.
Well, which is why the direct experience aspect is key in all of this. And I don't have any more answers than you do. I've got more questions maybe. But, you know, and thus here we are on an open search outward. And it looks like we're looking for the same answers in the end.
Yeah, I mean, the answer for me is that humanity is responsible for humanity, and individuals are responsible for themselves. The only thing you're in charge of is right now. You know, there's so many spiritual teachers that have thrown that out there. The only thing you're in charge of is right now, and people don't get it. It's just like, you know, some do, some don't. I asked, you know, Patty, when we were sitting in this landmark forum, because the facilitator was, you know, this was a sharp woman sitting in the chair, and nothing, no amount of anger or, you know, bile coming out of somebody's mouth, it didn't shake her at all. I mean, she was skillful at turning it around and dissecting these people into, you know, little pieces to help them understand, to the point they just broke down crying because, you know, they knew she was right, and it was their own game, their own shtick, their own story that they were running on themselves and had been running on themselves for sometimes 40, 50, 60 years, right? And when you realize that, it's a big awakening for them. So on the drive home, I'm going, why would somebody want to be a facilitator of that, to set up at the front of the room and listen to that from, you know, 100 people or 150 people? Why? And Patty just seems to look at me, and she goes, because they have chosen to live impeccable lives, and that's how they live. That's a powerful statement, is it not? They have chosen to live impeccable lives. That's why they are there. And that's why they are not influenced by the anger of others. They are there. Their calling and their purpose is to help these people, to help people find the solutions to what's broken in their lives. And we all have broken parts somewhere in us. And the question is, how do you address that? How do you embrace that? How do you, you know, not give it the kinds of things that darken your life and fill you with sadness and hopelessness and that kind of thing? So I wish I could say that I have chosen to live an impeccable life. I wish I could say that. But what I can say is that people like you, people like my clubhouse moderators and Patty and so many others, all the students, remote viewing students, have always made me want to be a better man. And that is a significant thing for me, because I really thought I was on top of my game as a young man, and found that I was not on purpose, and there was much that needed to be altered in my life as a remote viewer when I got awakened, you know. I thank you for being you and being where you've been in my life since, you know, you walked into a classroom back at University of Vancouver. And yeah, you know, it, all these experiences, this long chain of synchrodestiny events of meeting people, you know, person has caused me to say to myself, I want to be a better man for them. It doesn't mean I haven't stumbled in front of, but it is what I want to be. And it's always on my mind. It is part of me trying to be responsible for me moment to moment. And I feel so much that it's our lives are our lives to, you know, either cast away or to live richly and impeccably. It's up to us. And I don't know what the external forces would be that would, you know, that would modify, or to use an army term, grease the skids on our life in some way. But I love it that you say that you think that. I mean, it's good. And I know there are probably a lot of listeners that think that, but I want people to really be responsible for people.
Yeah. That's a big point of, you know, all of this is to be open-minded, but not to the point where your brains are dribbling out your ears. So, you know, that's why we talk about.
Or not
about,
to the point that you're expecting something else to do something for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and that people have humanity has a tendency to rapidly assimilate that ideology into their lives, expecting that something else is going to make it better, right? Or that something else is responsible for making it worse. You know, and anytime you're surrendering to that kind of an outlook or a belief, to me, it means that you're not taking responsibility in the moment for what you've done or not done or how you're living. And, you know, I don't want that to sound as an arrogant, and it may, but I don't want it to sound as an arrogant statement. For me, it's not an arrogant statement. It's very much a humble statement of accepting failures in my life and choices that were bad in my life, but also recognizing the strength that I gained from those and the experience and the wisdom that I gained from those. And I feel very comfortable in taking charge for both my failures and my successes and where I am at this point. And again, I love the fact that you are willing to embrace that there's another power that's influencing, you know, some of these things that you're, you know, in what we're talking about, these synchrodestiny events.
Well, my path was a lot different than yours, which we'll get into, I'm realizing, here and there as we go, but it was a lot easier for me to see a light go on when you're dark. And, you know, I didn't have any support. I was literally just this single-celled amoeba in this primordial look. And so it took a direct experience with something outside myself, or seemingly out. I mean, it may be our higher self, or maybe we're all God and we're all, you know, I don't know. I don't even like using the G word because there's too much, abuse around
too
that.
Many different things.
We need new terminology for something we don't understand, and who knows if we'll even ever understand it. It was easy for me to see is the point. It was like, and that's what it took for me to wake up. Do you have a scientific theory? Because I know you can draw a scientific graph anywhere at the drop of a hat to explain any of these theories. So what was your explanation for the ludicrous, the boom right when he was in the right spot of the sidewalk, and then the sign, and then the birth date, and then the weird response to, you know, acting like a maniac, and then the Hollywood director standing right there? Like, what are the odds of all of that, and how did you compute that into the equation of your explanation?
Well, let's back it up all the way back to Michael and Julie, right, and to Tony Robbins. I mean, all of these things are a sequence that goes into – it starts that when you're saying that this sequence of events or coincidences begins to happen and you're supposed to pay attention to it, the supposed to pay attention to it part is saying that you're responsible for how you are reacting to these things. The fact that those potentials, you know, exist or that they happen, they just happen. I mean, they're actually not part of, you know, the lineup of something. So when Tony Robbins believes some guy that's a corporate, you know, mogul that says you're running your stuff as a family, that's Tony Robbins' decision. And the other guy, you know, I laugh about it because I said, do you really think that the guy that's running his company and is this, you know, butcher, you know, I mean, like this laser-focused corporate, you know, guy, do you think that he sent laterally over to you his best staffer? You understand what I mean? So, of course he didn't. I mean, what kind of fool would do that? I mean, who would take somebody out of your staff that was working for you in your corporation effectively and making your corporation make more money and work more smoothly? Right there is a decision made by a guy to send somebody who was probably, you know, a lower performing member on his team, not the lowest, but, you know, not the top either, to Tony, who Tony then embraces and says, make it happen. That person calls in Michael and says, your wife can't work here anymore because I don't want it to be a family. It's got to be a business. Michael could have said, I quit. You know, or I'm out of here. But he said, no, let me work the deal where she can go over to the Chopra Institute. And she does. That's a decision then made by Mike. And then Julie in the Chopra Center says there's this synchronicity thing, and maybe you want to come and do this. That's a decision made by her. He goes. He sits right next to Gerald Butler. Gerald sits next to him. He hears this amazing synchrodestiny story. So now let's analyze that story. There was no big divine intervention to make a boom or, you know, something drop on the roof. Something just dropped on the roof. You know, somebody did something and it fell off the forklift, or, you know, who knows, whatever it was, and it fell off the forklift. The decision by Butler to look up, as everybody else did, that's just a decision in the moment. Seeing wherever he was going, but it was a decision in the moment to see that sign and then accept that in his definition of who he was and who he was supposed to be, to see that sign and say that must mean something. And, you know, it could have been 1,000 other people in that same situation look up and say, "Oh, it's my birthday, so what?" and walk down the street. But he chose to do that. He chose it. Got, you know, some divine intervention didn't put Simmons and Company established on his birthday. That happened when Simmons and Company established that birthday.
We don't know that because the other people, you know, that's the part that we don't know. We don't know that. I'm going to plunge you on that.
I know it.
Because we don't know that. And I'll tell you, here's the missing piece. Here's the missing piece. Is it would be most appropriate to be asking Gerard these questions, because when, here's the difference between a divine connection experience as opposed to all the left brain, you know, regurgitation, is there's a knowing and a connection prior to, during, and after of the experience, out seemingly external, coming from somewhere else. That's the difference. That's when I know.
That's what you read.
That's not what I read. That's what I experienced in the moment. In the moment.
Okay.
We're going to have fun with this one. Oh, my God. An hour's gone by already. Okay, I put on an extra hour this time. Thank goodness.
Yeah, and we're going to have to cut that, like, maybe at, like, 15 minutes short if we can, because I have to – I have another engagement. I apologize. It just got thrown at me. Is that possible?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, We can just do our normal hour and then pick it up next time and leave everyone at this exciting cliffhanger. Also, by the way, as you're talking, I'm thinking, hey, Netflix pitch, the next big hit show, Synchro Destiny. Let's talk.
Really?
Brilliant.
Really? Synchro Destiny's up on Netflix. See, that's synchro destiny.
Is it all already up there? Oh.
Is it?
No. Maybe it's not. Let's find out. Okay, now I'm on Google.
See, because I was just acting in the moment, I just skewed that off out into some other destiny, synchro destiny trail. I sent that potential off out into, you know, someplace else where it'll land.
I'm
again
Googling it now.
Later date.
TV show. There we go. Nope. There's a talk on Deepak show. It's wide open there. Patent pending. Okay. There we go. So, Dave, is there any moment you can think of? I mean, you have a very left brain approach. I'm sure you agree with that, right?
Really, you think? I mean, I think I have a. I live in my right brain a lot, and that I was trained as a scientist, so even though I was an Army officer, I was scientific about a lot of things that I did, particularly like training, you know, and I think that I live in my right brain a lot, and I'm very emotional about being in my right brain, but I am also very careful to try to come back to and scientifically analyze what it is I'm experiencing and what others are experiencing. And I've spent decades, Nicole, trying to take really complex interpretations of things, which seem to be like the most popular crap that people throw out there today. It's like they just love to stand up and seek some sense of significance in their life. It happens a lot on Clubhouse. People will come in and start talking, and I can hear in the first sentence, and I've told the moderators, I can tell in the first sentence what this person is trying to do. And people will come in and speak fantasy physics, you know, where they're tossing out words and other stuff, and it's like, stop it! You know, you're speaking gibberish, and you know, but you're trying to present to people like you're intelligent, and indeed, often they are in their own fields. Like some of them been a computer scientist, but being a computer scientist, I had a guy the other night come in and go, "Here's how I know that you know we set up a computer program and the internet structure and stuff like that. How does that relate to, you know, what you're talking about in remote viewing?" I was like, "Are you kidding me? I mean, you're asking me to draw parallels or describe the difference between socks and fish. You know, don't you understand that?" But they didn't. He's like, no, but you know, I was like, oh, God. So I think I live a lot in my right brain because I believe in the eternal nature of humanity. I believe in the omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence of humanity. I believe in that. I mean, I don't believe it. I know it because I, again, have seen it with irrefutable evidence.
Exactly.
And so have you. So I believe in that. And to know that and walk through life knowing that is very definitely a right brain, you know, approach to it, to try to be walking in both worlds. But I walk in another world that I can't escape, and that other world for me is anything I see or anything I hear, I have to tear it apart and I have to look at it and see, is it real or is it fabrication or, you know, what is this? And I even do that in my business, right? Like when I was the director of tests and evaluation at the National Center for Medical Readiness, that was my job was people come in and say something and try to sell something like a hypothermia prevention management kit. This was a big one, and they were fielding it into the military, especially particularly into special operations. And it was something that was, you were supposed to be able to put a wounded casualty in it, and it would this look like a sleeping bag with a particular iron ferrous oxide liner in it, and it was supposed to warm the casualty because hypothermia is a silent killer and on the battlefield when somebody's wounded. And this thing, it wasn't working, you know, so people were saying it doesn't work. So my job was to take that and to run a test from below sea level to sea level and at 1,000-foot increments all the way up to 14,000 feet. And I did that. And you know, we had a team, and you know, I was the guy inside the sleeping bag, so to speak. And what we determined, what we found, is that at 3,000 feet, there are no longer enough moles of oxygen to cause the ferrous oxide chemical, this reaction with ferrous oxide, to have the ferrous oxide actually create warmth. So at 3,000 feet, it became a worthless item, and they were selling it to the military for use in Afghanistan for combat up at 8,000, 12,000 feet, right? So you see what I mean? That has been my life now for 45 years, maybe, close to 50 years, is analyzing training or analyzing things like that, testing tourniquets and, you know, trying to find out what's wrong or what's right about things. And I've listened to physicians stand up and bald-faced lie. Manufacturers lie, Army officers lie, Army NCOs lie. Surgeons, people in critical positions, you know, lying about the capabilities of something that they are backing, you know, financially. And so I'm distrusting of those things. And right? And it's difficult to separate those. Yeah.
Yeah. Understandably.
So my life is that.
So your default setting, you've been programmed, and it's not, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's your default setting, right? You remind me of my cameraman. He his background was CNN, and, you know, so he was more entrenched in, you know, ready to debunk this stuff, right? And once in a while, we'd have a genuine experience that I know he felt and got in the moment. But he would backtrack his way out as the left brain would sink in and just go, well, maybe that wasn't real, you know. So my question was, have you ever had a moment where you just felt something connecting that was bigger, that just for a moment you went, oh, was that, you know, something?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, there we go.
I'll tell you what I have had, though. I have had evidences of just a human purity and goodness, of fairness and people honoring people for the gifts and the things that I'm getting emotional for, the gifts and the contributions that they've made, where, you know, in many cases, those people are ridiculed, ostracized, ignored. And then I have seen instances of where that has shifted for them. And for me, that isn't the human beings recognize the contribution of this being, of this human being. And then they, you know, there's this outpouring of love and connection, and, you know, and it is, humanity has that potential. They have that in them, and it happens frequently. We just don't get to see it as often as we would like to see it. But, you know, you can read stories like that in books. You can read stories like that, and you can see it in real life. These are the things that, for me, allow me to recognize if there's a divine, it's the divine nature of humanity. When we can either butcher each other, or we can truly express love and appreciation and uplifting and caring, contribution, service to one another. And that is within us. We've been gifted with the ability to do that. The divine nature in us that's tied to the eternal, omnipotent, omniscient, this omnipresent, which we scientifically know exists for us. That, to me, is, that's the divine nature of humanity. And yes, I've seen that. And yes, you know, I believe in that. I don't understand the idea of an external force, of something else stepping in and making that happen. But again, I appreciate that you do. And I understand why you do. And it's, I think it's important that you do. I do. I really do. Not to be repetitive with the do. Which I just was.
We're going to have an interesting journey. One of my goals is to see if we can have Dave have a moment.
I just had a moment. I just practically broke out in tears for you, talking about, you know, the things that I do see that I would define as the divine, you know, the divine nature of humanity. Treating each other the way we're supposed to, you know, recognizing each people as we're supposed to recognize them. I mean, there have been tremendous, you know.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
And now you get this shamanic perspective of what is there in an etheric form in these particular power places. So it's a really powerful experience, an amazing experience. You know, as practical as I am about those kinds of things, I will tell you that I personally witnessed those lights above the horizon. The steps were 6 feet high, you know, they were just huge. They weren't human steps. It was some sort of a ceremonial site, which looked very much like it had to be a site, or could have been a site, where something came and landed there.
welcome to News for the Soul. This is Daniel Brinkley.
This is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
Okay, everybody, take a deep breath. We know that we choose to come to this world, and we're chosen to come to this world, and we've come for breath. We breathe in for ourselves and out for spiritual unfoldment. And as we breathe these moments, let's open up our heart and open up our souls, and let the true awareness of News for the Soul make its impact now and forever.
Good evening. This is News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. Back after a little bit of a hiatus and an adventure in Peru, we're back, and he's with me here today, the person we were in Peru with, Dr. David Morehouse, former CIA remote viewer, and we're going to be talking about what happened in Peru. Welcome back, David.
Hi. Good to be here.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
At this point, it's good to be anywhere. So it was good to be in Peru. What an adventure. I'm not even sure where to start. But how about at the beginning of why remote viewers were in Peru?
Well, it's an annual trip that we make. And the reason we go there primarily is because we're trying to offer kind of an extraordinary experience for both novice remote viewers all the way up to the advanced remote viewers, many of whom were there were very advanced. And, of course, we had a few people who this was their, they had done the home study course with us, or they, some of them had just taken the basic course. But the idea is to take remote viewers there to go to this really wonderful, magical, beautiful country of Peru, and various sets of circumstances, from temple work to actually standing on the ground of sacred sites. And the intention in being there is for a collective experience as well as the individual experience, but primarily for this collective experience, for viewers to go there, to be together in these places, and for us to remote view these sacred sites, you know, to open ourselves by doing these various initiations and sacred ceremonies at these sacred temples, and then to remote view a particular power place or sacred site, and to carry into that particular place as we stand there physically this non-physical awareness of what it is that we perceive there, this beyond the surfaces, if you will, experience of being from a viewing perspective. That gives you this, you know, you go into it, and we give you the old archaeological perspective, which says, you know, here's what we know about the Incan times, and, you know, maybe a new archaeological perspective, if one exists for that particular site, which says, here's what we know about Incan times, and here's what we know about pre-Incan times and what may have existed here. Then you have this collective remote viewing experience, you know, using focus questions to try to answer specific things. And then you have Jorge Delgado, who is, you know, the shaman which goes with us, and now you get this shamanic perspective of what is there in an etheric form in these particular power places. So it's a really powerful experience, an amazing experience. And now the 2 years that we've done it, it's just been, I mean, you just can't ask for a better group of people. You just can't ask for a more focused and dynamic and purposeful, committed, loving and compassionate gathering of people that are there in these places, all pulling together to master this collective and as well as individual experience. And you were there.
Oh, God, yes, I was there.
There you came out of Vancouver down at sea level where you were and stepped into 12,500 feet. That's the first time I saw you when you showed up there.
Yes, I
walking
whooshed
quite slowly and lightheaded.
Very slowly, but
camera in hand.
3 steps at a time. I was looking at the footage, and you can hear me wheezing up the hill to catch up with you guys.
Well, you just put music to it.
Yeah, very loud music. You know, that's the thing is it was, we sort of idealized the spiritual aspect of these sites and, ooh, Machu Picchu, you know. And it's a real spiritual warrior trek almost, really,
Yeah, it really is. But again, you know, I can't say it enough. You see the pictures of places like Machu Picchu. You see the places of pictures of like Ollantaytambo, Silistani, Wiracocha Temple, the Monkey Temple, the Moon Temple, the Sun Temple, all of these things that are Huayna Picchu, you know, and the different islands that we went to that see to visit the Oro people to, you know, and even to Chiricahua. I think I didn't say that correctly. I never do. But to make that trek that we made, which is 60 kilometers and, you know, increases of anywhere from 6,000 to 7,000 feet in elevation, it was an amazing journey and a journey that which normally is not made by such a diverse group. I mean, we had all ages, we had all sizes, we had all levels of experience of backpackers and, you know, hikers, and then...
You're talking about Chiricahua, the new Machu Picchu site.
Yeah, which, you know, it's so little of it yet excavated, but and so difficult to get to that not many people go. I mean, not many people. What this group experienced was something that, again, not many people have an opportunity to see because no group the size of our group goes there. And usually the groups that go there are smaller groups of two or three or four experienced backpackers.
Mm-hmm. I was researching on the Internet today, actually, about it, and a recent article that was posted had quoted something to the effect of, you know, less than 100 people this century have set foot on that site. Well, 120 now or so after our group. It was a significant jump in the number, you know, that they had recorded. So
yeah, and again, all age groups, all experience levels, all sizes, all, I mean, that was what was so amazing about it. And it hadn't been this kind of a group with these kinds of people, I just don't think it would have ever happened. I mean, the guides were quite amazed, and so were the wranglers that handled the mule team that carried our supplies and other kinds of things were just, and talking to Jorge later, they were just all amazed that this group pulled together, care of each other, and made it through that entire, that entire journey, that expedition to go see this place. And even though time was limited for us once we were there, we still had time to go there and have this sacred ceremony and initiation and time to meditate and be there, even though it was only a couple of hours as opposed to a half a day or a whole day, you know.
Well, I think once we all figured out where we were going and how hard the trek was, I think we were all amazed that we made it, actually. So it's not something that people should be taking lightly. I want to stress that. But it was worth the trek for various reasons. But before we get into that part of the trip, and kind of unveil what happened there and what we found there. Getting back to how you're saying about how we went into these sacred sites, these thousands of year old sacred sites, and not just seeing them, but feeling them and kind of remote viewing into them.
Yeah.
Was quite profound. And a lot of us had, you know, a lot of profound moments in there.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the big validation of that, of how profound it is, watching this man born and raised there, Jorge Luis Delgado, to watch him, this shaman, to watch his responses to what remote viewers are producing. That's really most of the fun of it for me, is not only watching what happens for the viewers and seeing what, you know, what occurs for them and how excited they are about what they found and how confirming it is for them, especially as they walk the ground that they were remote viewing hours earlier, or when they are remote viewing on the ground in which they're standing but being asked to look beyond the surfaces as remote viewers. What's best for me, just as a remote viewing teacher, is watching just the excitement in this shaman saying, yes, that's what we know. Yes, oh, my God, yes, you know, that's what we know. And, oh, yes, you answered this question and you came up with this piece of information. And he did that so often, and he feels so connected to these people who come from all walks of life and all over the world to be here as part of this group who then, you know, open to this understanding that just for him is a big validation for him and for a validation for his life's work and the things that he has been taught throughout his life, which is why he does so much stuff for you guys in terms of not simply giving a demonstration of a ceremony, but really performing an initiation and a rite of passage and preparing you for new levels of understanding. That's his commitment to the remote viewers that are there, as opposed to just you know, walking there and having an opportunity to listen to a shaman give his perspective, right? You get to participate in this pulling back of this gossamer veil separating two worlds. That's a powerful journey.
So how is it that you came to choose working with Jorge, and does he have an understanding of what remote viewing is?
Yeah, he has a really good understanding. The first year we were there, we went with the intention of teaching a class there. So Jorge sat in on the class, and again, it was just a validation and a confirmation for him of what it is that he felt he already knew and was capable of doing. He's been at this for many years, since as a young child. His training as a shaman began around the age of 11. But how I happened upon Jorge, or there came a meeting between the two of us, was really because of Theron and Marianne Mayle, who had been going to Peru for many years now, and they developed a friendship with Jorge. And this friendship with Jorge really became a triad between Don Miguel Ruiz and Jorge Delgado and me, and we just shared ideas and concepts about what could be done, what should be done. And Jorge has begun preparing this book, which Don Miguel is endorsing and or writing the foreword for, and which I am endorsing, and it is a book, a story of his journey, his progression, his learning. And when remote viewing was introduced to him by Theron and Marianne Mayle, the kind of coordinators for these two journeys we've made, he just opened immediately to it and was really excited about it. And then when he saw what the remote viewers were able to produce last year and this year, then his excitement level just continues to increase exponentially, because it's opening to so much more possibility for him. I mean, he really sees remote viewers as a tool with which to increase his awareness, to open new pieces of understanding, to provide data that is not otherwise available except through shamanic tradition. I mean, through shamanic tale and lore and sharing of stories. I mean, they're sharing stories about etheric flames and the colors of a flame, and then in the blind, viewers will go in and look at this thing and come back with the presence of a flame and the color of the flame, which validates what the shamanic legends have been. So it's not that one replaces the other. It's just that they begin to augment and complement one another, and that's what he really loves about it, as well as do I.
So when we were going, I mean, it was a marathon of sacred site after sacred site. I mean, there's so many there, and we probably only saw a smidge of what's really there. But many of us were experiencing things that were beyond words, you know, and I noticed that you were there participating right along with us in these ceremonies, and some of them seemed pretty moving for you as well. Do you want to share a couple of what those experiences were, that more moving, profound experiences?
I mean, mostly what happens when I come there, I mean, sure, I'd love to share with you. Most of what happens when I get there is I make it really clear to the participants that my job in being there as a remote viewing teacher is not to be there necessarily to each time participate in all of the ceremonies with you. My job is to be a videographer and a photographer along with other individuals, because we really try to we want to make a really great video record of the experience and turn that into a DVD, which we give to all the participants, and a really great photographic record of that, which we give to all the participants. And so often when you're in the circles and you're doing the other things and doing that work, you know, there's a guy running around the outside doing the video and the photos and stuff like that, which is usually me. Occasionally another member of the group, but we're trying to get that group experience and cohesion put together there. But in one particular place, most people recognize that I see that as my calling in this particular place, is not to be the teacher. The teacher is Jorge, and I am there to be just the leader of this expedition and to really serve in a kind of a practical role. But Theron walked over to me at this place called the Monkey Temple, which is where the Heart Rock is, and as one of this temple where we were doing this preparatory work, all of us were there, and Theron came to me and said very quietly, "Why don't you just turn the camera off, and why don't you just be in this place, because it's a really special place?" And of course, I'm kind of looking at him like, "What do you mean, turn the camera off? The camera has to be rolling, you know." But he just reaches up gently and takes the camera from me, and you know, turns the camera off, and I lie down on this, just in the grass, in the ground of this particular place, and I am just suddenly so overwhelmed with love and compassion and just enveloped by the spirit and the energy of this place that tears begin to just pour from my eyes just uncontrollably. And then in just being there in maybe 20, 30 minutes in this ground, I just felt so much a part of and connected to something that was so amazing. And it happened so quickly that it was something that every human being ought to experience once in their life, just this unconditional love from this Pachamama, from the earth itself, from this connection to the earth, the inner world, the present world, the upper world, the cosmos itself, this authentic aspect of oneself being there on that ground. And then to be able to go forward to the Heart Rock and to embrace the Heart Rock with Jorge behind you, preparing and initiating and uttering the incantations as you are there, these ancient thousands of years, these words have been spoken at this particular place. Again, there is this experience that is just overwhelming, this connection at a level beyond, that really just defies language, that I experienced there. I mean, and that was just one place, and we went through so many,
and it was so profound. Like that. It's true. It's beyond words.
Yeah, three days at 3 weeks at basically attending either two or three particular sacred places per day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty full plate. I mean, people were exhausted. We were getting people up, and we were up and out and on to to the temple work at early in the morning, so we were there by 8 o'clock, and 8 or 9 o'clock doing the work, and then from there to the next place, and from there to the next place, and back home again at 7 and 8 o'clock at night, and people getting a little sleep, and then back at it again the next day.
Well, that and also dealing with the realities of traveling to Peru, the altitude sickness, and other potential health problems.
That which you alone experienced.
Oh, God. Flat out on the Lima, Peru airport floor. Yes, I did.
You have to make sure that when you're going there, you're going to a developing country, and it's just a matter of, that's why we start, we were starting high and working our way down from there. We wanted to start high up at Lake Titicaca at the highest altitude, and it takes you a couple of days to get acclimated, and then from there, if you're in moderate physical conditioning, it's a couple of days to get 2-3 days to get acclimated, and from there, if you'll notice, we had a plan and we had a system. We gradually increased the lengths of the walks. We gradually increased the severity of the inclines, and declines in the walks. We had a whole program and a plan for how we did it.
Yes, which would have worked out excellently if it weren't for the fact that I arrived 5 days late.
Yeah, you missed all the acclimation.
I did. But, it was worth the wheezing because, one of the sites and ceremonies that seemed to be really profound besides the monkey temple was the sunrise ceremony at Machu Picchu.
Yeah, that's always a really powerful one. And then to go flying on the Condor Rock to do the sunrise ceremony there is very profound.
It's again beyond words. Like I couldn't understand why we were all feeling so emotional.
And it's also something
sun.
You don't see happening there. I mean, when you look around, when you're there, it's this group that's doing these kinds of things. The vast majority, you look around this thing, and it is, there are lots of people coming there to say that they have seen and stood there on the ground of Machu Picchu, but there are not many, if any, other people. I have, in 2 years' time, at least in the days that I have been there, I have not witnessed, not once, any other gathering of people to conduct ceremonies and initiations. And that's not to say it's not that it doesn't occur, and I'm sure that there are some listeners that have probably seen or participated in those kinds of things. But in the time that I have been there, now 2 years in a row, I have not witnessed that. But this group is always doing that. First up there in the morning, there before the sun has even come up, and they're in position to receive their instruction, and then you are in this powerful place where for millennia, human beings or more have stood on this very same ground in this very same preparation with these sharing and connecting to the ritual of these thoughts throughout millennia, this energetic representation of all life that have stood there to watch the sun come up through these over this particular place in the mountains to watch the rays of sun crawl down from the mountaintop until they finally touch your face and embrace and envelop your body again. And there again, there's not a dry eye in the house, because it's just the experience and the connection of those who have come before that have been in this place. It was amazing just to look around and to see every person with tears streaming down their face simply from the preparation and then the being in this place, this ancient place, and in this ceremony as old as time itself. Oh, it was amazing.
It was, and it was really powerful for everybody there. I mean, my mind was thinking, you know, what's the big deal? It's a sun. You see it every day. Hello. But, you know, like you say, it's beyond words. It's feeling this history and the intention behind the exercise and experiencing it in a whole different way.
Right. The stones, you know, the stones, the walls, the ground, it all speaks. I mean, it's there. It's what a remote viewer lives for, is that seeing beyond the surfaces, seeing and feeling beyond the surfaces. It's what anyone with a spiritual quest in their life seeks, which is that ability to connect beyond the surfaces of things, beyond just what the physical can see or touch or feel, but to really feel, if you will, into the quantum level, into the energetic level, because at that level there are no definable edges, which means that the history of that place continues there in this energetic level. And being there, being present there, connects you to that, and your whole body feels that, and your soul feels that, and your mind connects to the mind of those who have come before for the 20 and, you know, 10 and 20 and 30,000 years before in this particular place. And as everyone there knows, even Jorge knows, it's like, you know, the reign of the Inca, which was, you know, 500 to 1,000 years, that was a minor remnant reign of these particular places. These things were assembled, built, put there, lived there, you know, blessed and created and existed for millennia beyond the Inca. For millennia, and to be a part of that and share that, if only for the time it takes for the sun to rise up over the mountain, then that's a magical time of one's life that can never be fully explained only in language.
Has to be experienced personally, firsthand, really, to get it. So, do you want to explain to them what the condor flying was?
Well, and we'll send some pictures, and they'll be posted on the web so that you can see them, the listeners can see them there. There's a particular rock that's there that's called Condor, the Condor Rock, and most people don't know what that rock is for, but the way in which the rock is shaped as a place where you sit, and it is shaped to fit a human spine, and so you sit on this rock and lie back on the rock, and your head then is extended backwards over the rock, and you're looking thousands of feet down. I mean, you're not actually, I mean, if you were to fall off of the rock, which you wouldn't, you'd fall about 30 feet or so, but, I mean, from ledge to ledge, the sensation is that you are now upside down looking through the valley around Machu Picchu upside down. And, of course, as you know, that we had the condor feathers and the Andean eagle feathers all put together in ceremonial handles so that each person, when they were on the rock for their time on the rock, were holding the condor feathers. And it was a place where you were, in Incan and pre-Incan times, a place where a human could, in that position, then link with the visual reference of flight as if one were a condor. And you have this sense then of being this powerful spiritual power animal soaring above this sacred place. And, that's after the sunrise ceremony that is there. And then there's also another place where you are taken, where you're shown where you can kneel or stand on this other particular rock and close your eyes and feel through your heart and through your mind's eye the sense of what Machu Picchu is and what's really significant about it, besides just the grandeur and the beauty of the construction and its location, but really the energy of the place, being able to stop looking and to begin experiencing and feeling rather than thinking about what it is that is there.
Feeling what it is, that's exactly what it is. And I have to thank you for prodding me on to do that condor flying.
Because I probably would have pulled the I'm filming card, taken out of it. Those of us with height issues, it's a bit challenging to see the leaves to be dangling over, you know, thousands of feet of valley. But
yeah, when people see the pictures, they'll get the reference for it. When they see it, they'll be like, I don't blame Nicole for not having wanted to do that. But, you know, you have all these guys that are there. You know, you had Troy and me and others and all, you know, all these guys that will help you in the position. And, of course, Jorge right there talking to you, holding your feet. I know that doesn't sound comforting the way I'm describing it.
No, when Jorge, holding the word dangle over the cliff, you know. You pretty much lost them there. But, no.
Of course, you know, the other one where but right next to the doorway, the portal to where, if you'll remember,
Emma Mamuro or something?
Jorge was holding Omar by the belt. He was testing, you know, testing Omar, the strength of Omar's belt, so that Jorge could sit there and hold him by the back of the belt while Omar leans out over, you know, several hundred feet of cliff and opens his arms to, and closes his eyes to fly in his mind's eye like the condor to soar through the valley, kind of in this, this very present lucid dream or viewing, if you will. But it's just kind of funny to see some of the practical stuff. So, you know, how strong is your belt before I do this?
It was quite funny because that was actually when I just finally wheezed my way to the top of the hill to catch up with the group. That's what was happening. And I remember standing there looking on in horror thinking, oh, God, do we all have to do that?
So Jorge was, oh, no, we'll all fly when we get you to Machu Picchu.
Exactly. But happy we did. Boy, it's the thing. It's you know, we'll be posting footage and photos up soon, and you can kind of get a better idea of what we're talking about on newsforthesoul.com, actually on lifechangingtv.com as well. But it's a feeling thing. It's not like going there and just seeing, just looking. Like you're saying, all these other tourists were kind of there, but not seeing or feeling what we were feeling, not having the same experience.
But marveling at the experience we were having. I mean, and even in the resonant chambers and other things at places, you had people from other groups trying to kind of like just stand next to this group because of the energy and the love of this group. People wanted to be next to it. They were drawn to it. They felt it. It wasn't what was being said. It was what they were feeling again in this place that they were being drawn to. Because what was being said was, you know, if you're really looking just for a litany of information, you'd be better off to buy the guidebook and pay one of the approved, stamped, sealed, you know, authorized Machu Picchu guides to drag you all over the site and say, well, this was this and that was that and this was this and that's that. But to be part of a group that experiences the site from an energetic level, a cellular level, you know, a viewer level, a dissolve yourself into the site itself level, then you wanted to be with this group because that's what people who were, you know, people who had a spiritual connection and even beyond that were drawn into it. And you know, again, you go back into this really diverse group, you had people from all walks of life, from people in the business world and VP of Sony Music and, you know, and guys from, you know, from the contractor, operative, you know, security world to mothers to, I mean, retired people. You had everyone. It wasn't just a bunch of spiritual guru-focused kind of people that were there. It was people from everywhere, and all people in that group began to be connected and to feel and sense and understand the significance of what it is that they were involved in. And that's so powerful for me to see that happen. It's the big gift to me is to watch just the faces and feel the heart and the tears and see the smiles and the successes and the growth that take place in the people who make that journey. Do the things that they might otherwise say, I could never do that.
You know what we have to do? Take a quick break. After this commercial, though, I want to come back and talk about that last week, the trek to Chuquicero, what we found there, and what was profound about that trip.
Okay.
We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. David Morehouse, former CIA remote viewer. If you've missed any of the show or any of our shows, go to newsforthesoul.com. We'll be right back after this with more.
Hello, everybody. This is Damian Brinkley. Welcome to the hearts and minds of Informant. This is News for the Soul.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Visit newsforthesoul.com anytime to hear all of our shows, read positive news, and interact with like-minded people from around the world. Now let's get back to the show.
And we're back. This is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. Here, back from Peru and talking to former CIA remote viewer Dr. David Morehouse, who is leading this intrepid trek that culminated into a four-day hike. Well, it was a lot more than a hike, into Chuquicero being built as the new Machu Picchu site, and it's quite the ride getting in there. But, you know, we found something interesting, didn't we, David?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. You were quite excited.
Oh, about the top?
The top. Tell me about the top, David.
when we were up at the very top, there, some of us arrived because, you know, we had walkers, and then we had some folks who were riding and other things.
And then you had the people like me who were limping in.
Yes. We kept the people riding the horses to the rear just in case we had any medical emergencies and, you know, that kind of stuff. So the hikers arrived first, and so as the hikers came in, we had just about 2 hours of sunlight left, and so there were four of us that continued on, as exhausted as everyone was, continued on the half hour, 35 minute from the base camp on up to the site itself. And once up on the site itself, we're looking around at the site, moving around. We were the only ones up there. We were taking pictures. It's just an amazing, amazing thing. And it was, you know, getting ready to watch the sun go down in this gorgeous valley of tremendous magnitude, just watching that go down. But there was a point from where this site was that just had a stairway that went down over and then a small path that went up, and it was very much an integral part of the site. It was kind of like looking at Huayna Picchu, which is attached to Machu Picchu, but this particular site at Chuquicero, you look at it and it is just this mountain, which is probably 75 meters in diameter, but the whole top of it is just chopped off perfectly flat. And it's chopped off perfectly flat, and it's near perfectly round, and it has a wonderful, you know, pre-Incan wall built around this thing. So as the four of us look at it, we look at it, and the first thing that comes to our mind is, well, that's like a landing zone. And we're thinking, the two of us that are ex-military guys, we're thinking, like, well, that's a landing zone for, like, helicopters. And then we kind of snicker, and it's like, yeah, but there weren't any helicopters at that point. So, nor now up there at that height. So this is not a helicopter landing zone. This was a pad, because when you go up there, there's nothing there but just this ground. And so somebody from the group said, well, it could have been a playing field of some sort. And we're thinking, looking around, going, right. That would like be having a tennis court up here, you know. How many, whatever it is that you thought you were playing with, do you think you would knock over the wall, which was only 3 feet high, and then it would drop down 2,000 feet, and you'd have, of course, run down to pick the ball up and come back up again. So just jokingly, that was an just not probable that it was a playing field of sorts. It was some sort of a ceremonial site, which looked very much like it had to be a site, or could have been a site, where something came and landed there. Now, that's where I left that at that point, and that's where Troy and Nancy and Rebecca and I, we looked at it and we went, yep, could have been a landing site. Really kind of looks like it could be a landing site, and don't really know what else it could possibly be. There were no ruins, no foundations. There was nothing on it except this mountain with the top cut off perfectly level, or seemingly so, near perfectly round, 75 meters in diameter, maybe 100 meters in diameter, and with about a 3-foot wall, 1-meter high wall all the way around. around it and a stairway up to it or a pathway up to it, and very much a part of Chococirao. I mean, within 50 meters from the main, 100 meters within from the main structures of Chococirao. There were also some other interesting aspects of Chococirao. There was a particular place between two of the main structures that, and I'll give you a picture for this to put on the website, but there was a place where there were steps, but the steps were enormous steps. The steps were 6 feet high. You know, they were just huge. They weren't human steps, but there were on the sides little human steps. Now, when you first look at something like that from an archaeological perspective, you're saying, well, it could have simply have been architectural, and that's true. It could have simply been architectural. It certainly wasn't agricultural, which is kind of an oddity when you're looking at things there. You're looking at it and saying, well, it's not agricultural because these were not terraces that were being where they were planting and growing. This was a narrow set of stairways, kind of like what you would see in the Sun Temple in other places in Copan and other places in Mexico, where you see the Sun Temple, these large square pyramids with a set of aligned steps going up to the center. The difference being that the lined set of steps going up through the center from the bottom to the top were 6 feet tall. The steps were 6 feet tall. So the rise of the steps, the rise and the landing of the steps were equally, they were like 6 feet, then 9 feet, 6 up, 9 feet back, 6 up, 9 feet back. But then there were little people steps, you know, put in to the left and the right-hand sides of this so that human beings seemed to be capable that you could walk up it and then you would have to traverse across the big step and go up the next set of, you know, four steps and traverse across and the next set of four steps and traverse across again to get yourself to the top. So I took a picture of it. So we were then, like, just in our mind kind of putting these things together, all of us kind of smiling and saying, okay, we're not drawing a conclusion here. We're just throwing out a possibility that we have a landing strip and then we have some sort of steps here that are built for things that are definitely not, I mean, standard human size. And if you're looking at most Incans or Incan descendants, they're shorter than we are, you know. They're all well under 6 feet and pushing mostly around 5 feet. Most of the women are under 5 feet. Most of the men are between 5 feet 5 inches tall, 5 feet 6 inches tall. So this was just an unusual set of stairs and an unusual platform to be a part of this site. And this site was, they estimate what, they're saying 13 to 15% of the site is at this juncture excavated, and the rest of it is, I mean, there's so much of it that they're still just trying to restore and excavate.
It covers the entire mountain.
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere.
Right down to the bottom.
It's everywhere you look, right on up to the glacier, which is, you know, the glaciers, which are not very far above us, as you well know, having huffed and puffed up the mountain, that the glaciers and the snow-capped mountains are right there. But then here we are all standing in this particular place, looking at it, marveling at just the structure and why, asking ourselves why these kinds of conditions are existing. And then, you know, above our head comes three condors just soaring majestically, just 50 feet above us, you know, 50 to 100 feet above us, just not a wing flap among them, just giant 9 and 10 foot wingspans, and they just cruise out over the top of us and, you know, circle around a bit looking at us. And of course we're all thinking, looking at us as though we might potentially be food. but of course not. They're looking for Andean rabbits or something else, I'm hoping, and they just keep on cruising then out over the, you know, out over the over this massive valley with thousands of feet down, you know, 7,000 feet down. It's just amazing. It's just amazing. I mean, how do you describe it?
I don't know how we really get this across without people experiencing it and seeing it, because it's beyond words. Again, you're feeling into these sites, and this was, I wish we had more time at that last site, because, well, I didn't know about the steps. Definitely send me the picture about the steps, but some just amazing energy, we'll say, was coming off that site.
Oh, yeah, you have to see the site, the steps. The steps were absolutely, you looked at those things and went, yeah, these, I'm looking at a set of them right now. It was just that you just went, yep, nah, these were not people steps, so.
So, I mean, as a remote viewer, what are you sensing beyond the surface of those larger steps?
Well, again, it would be something that what I sense and what I view would be two different things. So I didn't make it a target, and I haven't looked at it. I may do that in the future, but I didn't at that time. So all I can say to you is what I just, when I looked at it, just from being from a scientific, practical, archaeological perspective, I looked at it and I had no understanding of why steps would be like that unless the steps were there for just an architectural perspective. And again, that's a possibility. But my gut tells me that I didn't see that anywhere else. You know, I didn't at Machu Picchu or at any of the other sites that we have been to there see that example. That doesn't mean that that's not the case, because you can see a building in downtown San Diego or downtown Vancouver, right, in the city, that you might not see that building anyplace else. It may be architecturally unique. And so I'm not minimizing it. I'm just speaking as a practical and from a scientist from a scientific perspective, and I'm saying that I did not see that example, that architectural example, anywhere else in 2 years of journeying there. So to have seen it there in that place, and then to have seen this bizarre little pad or large pad, where at that altitude, just having the top of a mountain neatly removed, and it was quite a bit. I mean, if you followed the line of the mountain up, and when I give you this picture, you can draw a line, and if you see what was removed, where there again, most of the time that wasn't done. I mean, that's the whole beauty of most of the structures there, is that they are pinned and neatly laid into the creases and the crevices, and terracing and the direct, and directly perpendicular to the fall line of these particular mountains, which are quite steep. It's odd to see a place where suddenly the entire top of the mountain is removed.
Yes.
It's just gone. And if you follow it up, it means several hundred feet of this particular point of the mountain were removed. It's not the whole mountain itself, but I mean it's a point of the mountain. It's a piece that comes out and forms its own small mountain top, which was removed to leave this small round, this 75-meter to 100-meter diameter pad that was up there, which is where we went to have our sunrise ceremony at that particular place, at Choka Kirao. And then I know that that night or early the next morning, because after we made the trek down the mountain, which was a very long and arduous day the next day, but in the bottom base camp before we began the 6,000-foot climb up out of the river valley to the mountain pass, and then making our way back into the village where we were picked up and removed by bus from there. But I know that there were amazing displays and dances of lights that were there that not just one or two people saw, but that 20 to 25 people saw and watched happening, and watched flashing and dancing and rolling and spinning. And there were some people who were trying to say, well, there's a campsite up that direction, but there was no campsite up that direction. And
well, not only that, but at some points those lights were above the
above the horizon and the tree line. And I will, as practical and as practical as I am about those kinds of things, I will tell you that I personally witnessed those lights above the horizon. And even if you wanted to say that they were lights in a campsite, then those guys that were in those lights, that had those lights in that campsite, were doing some amazing sets of acrobatics, leaping over the top of each other and somersaulting and spreading apart and dancing back together again and jumping over the top of each other, all while pointing their lights down at some other campsite, which they knew nothing about, down in the middle of complete blackness in this river valley. So, and in having walked up, the 6,000 feet, having come up the 6,000 feet in the switchbacks, those of us that were in the hiking group were constantly looking for evidence of other people and lights and another campsite where those lights may have been present. And I'm just telling you very just honestly and genuinely, they were not found. I mean, there was nothing else there. There wasn't a group of people camped on the mountainside, you know, somewhere that were, you know, dancing around with lights and shining down.
No, absolutely.
There just wasn't. That didn't exist there.
And at the speeds that I saw them going at, I mean, campers can't go that fast. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's preposterous to try. Is that as sometimes people, you know, take on ridiculous, you know, take minor conditions and turn them and over exaggerate them into ridiculous things. And that happened. It's also preposterous to turn around and deny what it is that you're seeing.
Yeah.
And without any kind of evidence to the contrary, to turn around and explain it away is
not that we know. Not that we're saying what we know what we saw, but that sighting, whatever
that's the best
it was.
Thing. Yeah, we don't know what we saw, but
it's
it
not
was
light.
Highly unusual.
Very.
And there was not the to explain it away as other campers, you know, dancing around with flashlights. That's as preposterous as it is to turn around and say, oh, I know it's you know. Pleiadians or whatever it is, they contacted me in my sleep, and there they are. I mean, it was just, you had 20-some-odd people standing there, including Peruvians and, you know, and mule wranglers and other people standing there, everyone watching this going, whoa.
Well, I know what it was not. It was not, you know, a helicopter or an airplane or a camper or a flying llama or...
or a condor with a flashlight.
No. I mean, I've never seen anything like that, and it was very dramatic. And that made the trip. That made the trip on top of, you know, finding this incredible site and, you know, seeing this alleged landing pad area and all these things and just feeling the site and then seeing that sighting that morning. That made the hike for me. It was worth every minute. And guess what? I got those lights on tape.
That's a good thing.
That's
a good thing. Yeah, you were, there was Nicole. I wish everybody could have seen it. You know, loping along on her mule, you know, and she had camera in hand, you know.
Yes,
and
my bureau.
And I saw her loping along on her mule. Nicole is writing notes and, you know, about what I'm going to talk about here and talk about there. Just so, you know, doing all the things she can do so that you can have the same journey she had.
Well, you know, it's interesting how things happen, because if I had known that I could only lope along on my burro half of the way, I probably wouldn't have gone, because I probably would have thought I wouldn't make it. So I'm glad that I did not know that going in, but definitely I advise people to have lots of time to do that trek if they're going in, and we were so lucky to have guides that kept us safe and everything. But are you going to do this trek next year?
Don't know if I would do Chocaquirao again. I would personally do it again in a second. But it ended up being it was a stretch for a lot of people. And next year, before I would do something like that or similar to that, I would be really select about who I allowed to go on it, just because it was such a stretch. But at the same time, it took a lot of people who would never otherwise do something like that and
beyond the limits. Absolutely. Well, I'm glad I went. Go to davidmorehouse.com if you want to find out about going to Peru next year. And we're out of time already. Thank you for everything, David.
Oh, thanks for having me again. And thanks to all the listeners and all the people that support News for the Soul. I really do appreciate it.
All right. Newsforthesoul.com. If you missed any of the show or any of our shows, we'll see you right here next week on News for the Soul.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Breathe.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to News for the Soul. This is Daniel Brinkley.
Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
From the heart of Vancouver, what a great place to bring News for the Soul.
I know, isn't it perfect?
dead zone, Christopher Walken.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was like that for real.
I think reasonably accurate, too, honey.
Oh, that's an understatement, honey.
Okay, everybody, take a deep breath. We know that we choose to come to this world, and we're chosen to come to this world, and we've come for breath. We breathe in for ourselves and out for spiritual unfoldment. And as we breathe these moments, let's open up our hearts and open up our souls. And let the true awareness of News for the Soul make its impact now and forever.
Well, Daniel just mentioned the heart attack. That is how he died, isn't it?
Yes.
Wow.
Actually, two heart attacks, one right after the other.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Wow.
No, I had him. I have him.
You know, the whole thing about the spirituality and the wealth or sustainability not going together, I just think is the biggest load of crap, you know? I mean, what have you got?
Like it is, girl.
Well, really, what have you got to give anyone if you've got nothing?
Buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, because Candace is going bye-bye.